You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Welcome to the Best of Flashpoints for the week of April 19th, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we devote the entire hour to an exclusive interview with legendary poet and author Alice Walker, who stopped by the KPFA studios to celebrate the station's and Pacifica's 70th birthday. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This past Monday, the 15th of April, Pacifica flagship station KPFA celebrated its 70th birthday. We were joined in studio by legendary poet and author Alice Walker. Here's that interview in full. Listen to this.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and we are honored to have in the studio with us Alice Walker. Let me just say a few things about her. Alice Walker is many things to many people. To some, she is a courageous hero, standing up for many of the things this KPFA Pacifica community believes in and is fighting for. Among them, a struggle for a free Palestine and against the endless wars that continue to fester and threaten the future. The basic facts. She is an award-winning, Pulitzer Prize award-winning novelist, short story writer, poet, and activist. She wrote the novel Color Purple, for which she won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize in fiction. And she's written some wonderful other books. Most recently, her latest book of poems is Taking the Arrow Out of the Heart. Welcome, Alice.
Thank you so much, Dennis. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, we're all delighted, as you can see, that you made it. And it is good that you're here. Well, there's so many things I want to talk to you about, but maybe I should start by saying, how are you doing? How are you feeling? How's life treating you these days? Are you excited about stuff? What are you excited about?
At the moment, I'm excited about going home. I've been away from home for, many days, and it's my favorite trip. I've been all over everywhere, and it just feels blissful to go home and, sit by a fire.
Yeah. I met you many years ago. We shared a teacher in Muriel Rukeyser, and when I decided to do the Muriel Rukeyser reading series, I got a note from Muriel with a check for $500, by the way, that said, Alice Walker lives around the corner from you. Maybe she wants to celebrate with you. And that's how we met.
Amazing.
And I hadn't written my first poem yet, so I read the poems that my kids were writing. I was teaching I was an emotionally disturbed teacher with rightfully troubled kids, working through poetry and through touch and mask making and stuff. And you read, I think it was your second book or third book of poems that you were reading from. You don't remember this, but, we were just talking before we went on air, but after the reading, it was about 11 o'clock. It was about 10 or 11 o'clock, and I got a call from you saying, could you please meet me at the bookstore immediately? And so I said, wow, I must have made a real impression on Alice Walker. And so I ran down there. I was all dabbered up, and you were pointing in the door at your pocketbook that was locked in the other side.
Yeah.
And I opened up the door. Your grace said, thank you. And you were gone. So much has happened. And I want to ask you about some of the things you've done, some of the people who mean a lot to you. Howard Zinn was your teacher.
Yes, he was. And he was for a semester. And then our friendship lasted for the rest of his life and on. Wonderful teacher. Funny. I took his class because I had gone to the Soviet Union from this little college in Atlanta. And I got there, and people were queuing up to see who, well, they knew where they were going. But anyway, I got in a queue that was going through Lenin's tomb, and I had no clue who Lenin was. but I had, you know, high curiosity. And I learned so much about the Soviet Union, you know, that they were just people that the U.S. was trying to figure out a way to bomb, and had told incredible lies about. And I was treated much better in Russia than I'd ever been treated in Georgia by white people. I mean, in fact, I was amazed that there were white people who knew how to treat people. I mean, I'd never experienced it, you know, before I met Howie, actually. So that's some of my interaction with Howie. He was a great, I came back to Spelman, I took his class, he was teaching Russian literature. And I was deeply in love with Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, and had been reading Gorky, and Howie was teaching all of that too.
Wow.
Yeah, he was amazing. I mean, he knew that you teach history not by just, you know, figures and facts and so-called facts, but by getting people's hearts moved for the people that are historical beings. So I loved him. I loved his teaching.
And I love the name of his autobiography, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. What does that mean to you?
Well, it means that you have to do something. You can't just pretend that, you know, all is well as the train is about to crash, which is what I think he was saying, that our train is about to crash. And being neutral at this point is really ridiculous.
Well, this is what I love about you as a writer, and also Muriel, that you're not only writing extraordinary things to enhance, you know, our consciousness and to give us hope and stuff. But then writing is not enough. Then you have to act. And those actions have won you many friends and some pretty good enemies. Could you talk about acting out beyond writing, and does it ever jeopardize your career, say, to take a strong stand in support of Palestinians? Do you ever think about that, or does that come together?
Oh, yeah, I've had many cancellations, just as we say in the South here recently. You know, people have just chickened out, you know, and said, oh, well, you know, we can't have you come because there's going to be a boycott, there's going to be a backlash there, people. In fact, next month, I'm supposed to be going to New Mexico somewhere, and these people that I thought were really quite upstanding and actually paying quite well, they decided that there was a boycott afoot, and they folded. And this also happened at the 92nd Street Y many years ago, actually, and I was just shocked that they, you know, at that point, I was with some other wonderful writer, and we had to go through the back door to get onto the stage. And after that, you know, they never call back, because I think they're just afraid. I mean, many of the people. But here's what I was going to say, because, you know, I spent all that time in Mississippi, and I saw what they did to Martin Luther King Jr. before he died. You know, I saw what they did to people. And how they abused people and called them all kinds of things. In fact, you know, there was a big billboard in Sunflower County when my husband and I illegally married, got to Mississippi. We passed by it when we were doing work in the Delta. The big photo of Martin Luther King at a Highlander folk school where they trained activists in the civil rights movement. But they had a big sign saying that he was in a communist school. So at that point, they were trying to label him a communist so that he could become more of an enemy in the South. So I'm very really well aware of how that tactic to smear somebody and to cause dissension, you know, and divide and rule. I know how that works. So there's nothing I can do. I was going to, you know, preface all that by saying, Howie, Muriel, and I, what gets us, you know, out of the chair that we're writing something in and on the street or, you know, wherever it is we're going, is basically love. You know, And it's such an activating ingredient. And we all three have it, had it, wouldn't give it up, think it's the greatest way to be, whatever happens. And I have no regrets. You know, I've been in some wonderful struggles and continue to be in some wonderful ones. And wherever I am just so blessed to be there. I am so thankful. I am so grateful because I get to be with the best people. I mean, I've seen some incredible beings on this planet. I wouldn't change that for anything.
Talk a little bit about Mommy Abu Jamal, an extraordinary human being who transcends his prison life and, you know, sort of lives in the ether for all of us. An incredible inspiration. How do you explain a consciousness like that, a ferocity of love of life that takes you that far, helps you to transcend? Where does that come from?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just talking to a wonderful friend today about Lumia and another man who was in solitary, I think, for 48 years. I still can't believe that. But I saw him on Democracy Now, and he just stunned me, and he just made me so happy to be a human being, you know, that we have that capacity. And part of understanding, you know, what that is, I think, is to study people like Mumia. I mean, here's somebody who's been in prison. How long have we been struggling to get this man out of prison? And he, meanwhile, has gone through tortures and torments and sicknesses and, you know, terrible treatment by, you know, so many. Writing his books, making his commentaries every week. In fact, we did a program just a week ago or so celebrating the second part of a trilogy that he has written called Murder Incorporated about the U.S. government. I mean, this is, you know, there are words for that. But even they are not adequate. This is a spirit just in flight, you know. I mean, this is a spirit that is just magnificent. And it helps us so much. It's like an ingredient and a just a wonderful something we are making, you know, together. And without it, we would be so diminished. But the conversation that I was having with a friend is about, you know, how do we learn to have that ourselves? You know, because we cannot continue to have these figures, you know, die for us virtually so that we can be enlightened. I mean, he is enlightening us, but through so much suffering. And what is called for is for us to develop our Mumia gene. You know, we have it somewhere in there. And we have to develop it so that he's not the only one carrying all this light. Now, we want to carry some light. And we can. Humans can do it. But we have to have a lot more faith, you know, in ourselves and in each other.
I think that, if you will, the prequel to Mumia Abu Jamal, and there really is nobody like him, but the extraordinary Turkish poet Nazım Hikmet, who ends up getting 15 or 20 years in jail because some soldiers loved a poem he wrote, and they put it up on the barracks wall, and then all of a sudden he's being, Nazım Hikmet, this great poet, is being accused of insurrection, leading an insurrection in an army barracks. Can you imagine serving 15 years for that? But he always was able to, again, transcend, you know, by keeping an eye on the higher good. And I'm always, Muriel talked about the prison gates as the gates of perception. Mm-hmm. I thought at first that was just a metaphor, but it's real.
Mm-hmm. It can be.
I spent a number of years teaching at Rikers Island Prison, mm-hmm. and what I noticed is you could go one way or the other.
Exactly.
You know, either you transcend or you go down fast and hard.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know, Alice, I have to tell you this. I forgot. I'm so nervous. But anyway, I forgot to tell you this in the opening, that you know that you were, it's amazing how things happen vicariously. But that reading that we did together, I had been for years trying to fight my way into WBAI. I would always show up at the door with an idea for another program. We could do a children's program, and it was always hard to get in. Then we did that reading series, the Muriel Rukeyser reading series, ended about 15 minutes. Somebody heard about it, and I got a call saying, can we put that series that you're doing on the air? Mm. And so if you Google, the first program that I ever did was preparing the reading that you did.
That's wonderful.
So you brought me into Pacific Radio. Thank you. I just wanted to tell you that.
Oh, what a beautiful story.
It's a fact. And I, you know, it's funny because I didn't realize that the archive has that program. So would you mind if I played one poem of you reading from that?
Oh, please. I'd love to hear it.
We've got some stuff. Mike, let's play a poem or two, huh?
Did this happen to your mother? Did your sister throw up a lot? I love a man who is not worth my love. Did this happen to your mother? Did your grandmother wake up for no good reason in the middle of the night? I thought love could be controlled. It cannot. Only behavior can be controlled. By biting your tongue purple rather than speak, mauling your lips, rubbing your eyebrows off against the sheets, bandaging your fingers too awkwardly to be able to phone. Love has made me sick. Did your sister throw up a lot? Did your cousin complain of a painful knot in her back? Did your aunt always seem to have something else troubling her mind? I thought love would adapt itself to my needs, but needs grow too fast. They come up like weeds. Through cracks in the conversation, through silences in the dark, through everything you thought was concrete. Such needful love has to be chopped out or forced to wilt back, poisoned by disapproval from its own soil. This is bad news for the conservationist. My hand shakes before this killing. My stomach sits jumpy in my chest. My chest is the Grand Canyon sprawled empty over the world. Whoever he is not worth all this. Don't you agree? And I will never unclench my teeth long enough to tell him so.
What do you think? Are you happy with that?
Oh, that was fierce. So glad that's done.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker. She's a friend of this radio network, which today is celebrating its 70th anniversary. And Alice Walker has been honored by Pacifica as one of our vigilant supporters. She's honoring us today by being in the studio. Can we talk about Zora Neale Hurston?
Yeah, but can we first talk about how the station has carried on? Last year, I thought it was going under.
We were in big trouble last year. We're looking a little better this year. Why don't you talk a little bit about why it's important to have this kind of free speech instrument in the hands of the people?
Well, because otherwise you are subjected to basically distortions of all kinds, and there's no way to understand, you know, what is the reality, what is the truth, you know, what is going on. And it really helps to have a station that you trust, that you have, you know, listened to for, I don't know, 10 or 15 years or however long, and you have a sense of who the people, you know, who they represent and where they come from and all of that, rather than just listening to these heads that just got out of the beauty shop. And it's very clear that they rarely even care about what they're saying, not to mention not know what they're saying, but they don't really care. Nothing is connected. I mean, the most scary thing, listening to some of the people on television, for instance, is just seeing that they're not really able to connect anything. I mean, they think it's all, you know, just hanging out there in separate shreds,
right.
And it isn't, you know. And so if you have a station that can, you know, with courage follow events and really listen to the people who are rarely heard from, in some of these, you know, global horrible situations, you have the possibility of actually being able to think about things in such a way that you can figure out what you can do to contribute to the change that has to happen in that situation.
And this was the genius of Howard Zinn in the sense of contextualizing history, because the first thing that newspapers do is take out the context, or major news organizations, and people don't see where we are coming from, if mm-hmm. you will, and what is happening.
Mm-hmm. And that's why people have to learn to sit with themselves enough to see how they fit. You know, how they fit within themselves, first of all, and then how they connect and fit with other people on the planet, not just in the neighborhood. Part of our problem, I think, is just that we're getting so insular, you know, and separated even more than, you know, 50 years ago, which is really crazy. So much so that I was just talking to someone about how our children often don't even know how to have conversation. You know, it's very hard for them to actually connect. Because they feel so cut off. They feel like there's always a gadget between me and whoever, you know, I'm talking to.
Can you look up? Look up. Here I am.
Right.
Here I am. But it is, you know, it is sort of the new world order. And I guess the positive side of that is there is the capacity to find context if you learn how to use that instrument and use it for the good rather than, you know, to make wars. Mm-hmm. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints. Dennis Bernstein here with Alice Walker. This is the 70th birthday of Pacifica.
Okay.
And this is my 30th year doing this crazy show. I must be out of my mind. But every day, every weekday, and that's why, Alice, that's where you come in again, because the way to stay sane for me is every morning at 5 o'clock, I get up and read and write poetry. I don't care if it's good, bad, or ugly. But, you know, 2 hours or 3 hours of, like, defensive action, you know, it's almost like weightlifting for the mind. Mm-hmm. Or just, you know, finding a place for the silence to happen, which... You know, I remember, you know, my first interview ever in this world was with Muriel Rukeyser, and I asked her, so I was very serious in this interview, like I was starting out to be with you. And I said, Muriel, what are some of the things that you really think we need to do something about? And the first thing she said was silence. Mm-hmm. There's not enough silence. Mm-hmm. And of course, I could end the interview now by demonstrating
how precious that is.
How precious it is. Mm-hmm. It is. But that sense of, you know, we live in this chaos, this world of chaos, and there isn't time to think. There isn't time to reflect.
Yes. Well, you have to, you know, want to have it. And I am a firm believer that once you understand that you very much need something like silence, something that you can actually, you know, have, then you can have the discipline to have that. I meditate, you know, I mean, it's not totally regular, but I studied well enough and have done it long enough to know that it is there, you know, that is, I need not be bereft of the silence when I need it and the quiet and the company of my own mind. So that's been very helpful. And I continue to have a blog. I started a blog when Obama was elected in 2008. And I find that really helps me with my inner balance of, you know, creativity. So that when I do have activity outside of that writing, it is informed both by quiet and by creativity. So I feel very fortified.
So before we... I do want to get to Zora Neale Hurston, because it's an extraordinary force in the world that you help to unleash.
Yeah.
But let's just spend a minute on coming back to Palestine and your commitment to that issue. It has caused you some...
Backlash
is the word.
Yeah.
When you read recently for KPFA, we saw it come up again. It was an interesting thing where someone in the audience, they were written questions and they accused you of being, why do you keep writing this anti-Semitic stuff? And your response was, okay, I'd like to meet you. Could you stand up so I can see who's making the critique? And you gave a good long time for somebody to stand up. Nobody did stand up. Nobody wanted to stand behind that statement, that accusation. How do you deal with that kind of sort of elusive accusation that, you know, I mean, we can see it big time in the Congress now. Just say something about the power of the Israeli lobby. And you could be a congresswoman, but they're already calling for you to be deported.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, if you see what is happening, you can say what is happening and suffer the consequences. You know, I mean, that's been my life. You know, as I mentioned earlier, when I went to Mississippi, you know, I was married illegally to someone at a time when the Klan was regularly bombing houses. And
illegally, as in white, or
well, yeah, he is white. He still is.
So it was illegal.
It was illegal. Yeah, it was illegal. Anyway, I don't know. I mean, you can only live your real life by being you. You can't live your real life by being somebody else or pretending. And hopefully, you know, you will survive long enough to actually have a life, you know, like Mumia. But that time that this person, you know, I don't know who that was, but I was so curious that whoever it was not brave enough to stand. I mean, that was the part that was interesting to me, because I'm willing to talk about it. I mean, what do you mean? I mean, where is it written? You know, why are you saying this? And I want people who are so quick to call people names to stand up and say why they're doing it. I mean, have the courage to just say why you are accusing someone. But most of them don't. Or they will do it in gangs.
Yeah.
Where they don't have to speak with words. They can just throw things. And that, you know, to me, it's not really a worthy way to stand up and be someone. I don't come from that tradition. I come from the one where you say what you think, and then you stand there, and you ask the person who's accusing you, why are you accusing me? And you wait for them to show up, and this person didn't.
It certainly would have been more enlightening if they did stand up.
Absolutely.
And express themselves in dialogue.
Why not? We could have a wonderful conversation about this. I mean, this whole thing, you know, this whole anti-Semitic thing. I mean, people should just interrogate that. I mean, it is, you know, a slur is a slur, but if you don't really understand what it's about, it's hardly worth your time. I mean, what do you mean? You know, that I was angry with my Jewish husband at some point, wanted to put him out of the house. Is that it? You know, that I didn't get along with my Jewish grandmother, I mean, my Jewish mother-in-law? Is that it? I mean, what are you talking about? But they're really talking about, or trying to talk about, Palestine. And why I really am so... Oh, God, just so... I suffer because they do. You know, I can't help it. I was there. I saw what's being done to them, you know. And if you see what is being done, what has been done to the Palestinian people, you would feel just like I do. I mean, if you have a heart, they are great people. And the way that the world has let this go on for over 60 years is just shameful.
Palestinians remind me very much of Jews for at so many different levels. You know, now my politics comes out of growing up in a neighborhood that was like 99% Christian, with a few Jews thrown in. And every Ash Wednesday, when the ashes showed up on the forehead, you know, they would reopen the Crusades and look for some Jewish kid to, you know, accuse of killing Christ. And I never said this on the air, but I named myself at age 12. I was having a fight every day, and I wasn't afraid. But it was, I called myself the first strike kike, because they were using it against me. And I said, okay, is that what you want to call me? Well, don't, you can call me anything you want. But I'm going to stand up for what I believe in. If you hate me because I'm a Jew, now, I've been in this movement for a long time. My grandfather was a famous rabbi. I don't know if you know this, Alice.
No, I don't.
And he lived on the Lower East Side, and he did two things. He wrote prayer and blessed matzah, and he was really a liberated human being for the time. Mm. And I learned a lot about, you know, coming across and being open to all different kinds of races. My mom was trained through, you know, she and her seven sisters came up under this rabbi, and they were all extraordinarily involved in social issues based on, you know, helping not just Jews, but mm-hmm. coming across. And I...
But you're not like the Zionists who are, you know, bulldozing people's houses. So, you know, you're just different people. I mean, you may have the same root, but you have to be different people, Dennis. So I can't quite see you bulldozing somebody's house and shooting children for fun. I mean, I just can't see it.
Here is the real positive story that comes out of all of that. So one day I got an email from a couple of rabbinical students in Jerusalem, and they raged at me. They said, we heard you were old, so we know you're going to die soon. And if you didn't die soon, you know, maybe something else will happen to you, God willing, and blah, blah, blah. And so I never answer those things, because sometimes it's frightening and it gets really dangerous, the things that people say. But I was so furious. I wrote back and I said, you know what? My grandfather was a famous rabbi. And, you know, one of the things that he taught us is to respect your elders. So I don't know who the hell you are, but if you think you're going to be a good rabbi by this kind of treatment of somebody, all wrong. Mm-hmm. And I sent it off, and I said, oh, God, why did I do that? Mm. A couple of days later, I got an email back from the same rabbinical student who wrote that horrible, horrible thing and said, we spoke to our teacher, and our teacher said we were wrong. Mm. That we could disagree with you, mm-hmm. but that our disrespect for your age and the kinds of things we said have no place in being a rabbi. So there was one positive thing that happened.
Great. Well, you know, take some of that over to Israel, to that rabbi who's calling black people monkeys.
Yeah, and snakes that need to be killed in the nest. And
yeah, well, whatever. But what I'm saying, though, is that people have to grow up enough to understand that just because people share a similar, you know, ideology or root from birth doesn't mean that all of the people are like that. I mean, that is what seems to be missing often. And I actually worry about my Jewish friends, you know, and I have been for a long time. I called a circle once with Jewish and African-American women so we could discuss how much danger I feel a lot of Jewish people are in. Just because, you know, they've, I don't know, been sleeping while Israel has been doing these things to the Palestinians all these years. And it does not, it's not good. I mean, there's no way that it can be good for anyone.
Again, this is the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Mike Biggs. Stay tuned for more with Alice Walker right after this.
We'll be right back. try. Weather as a finder, he stays a keeper. It is just a matter of time. So tell me when you think of it. Tell me how you do it. Don't see it right. Tell me how sad, stuck in contemplation, struck by no consideration, but you and I give it a better try. So tell me when you think of it, tell me how you do it, don't say goodbye.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and I speaking with Alice Walker, and we are celebrating the 70th anniversary of Pacifica. We are still here, and we're getting ready for 70 more years. Alice Walker, I loved reading Zora Neale Hurston and the sort of the liberation that, you know, the exalted nature of that woman refusing to become, to do the things that white people wanted her to do. The idea that she, her family, that she blew up, she grew up in an all-black township, that all her role models were black. She came up that way and she never lost that belief, you know, that to be black is not an inferior thing, as one would
It never crossed her mind to think that.
It never. Could you talk about, I mean, you essentially, we didn't know really about Zora Neale Hurston until you managed to go down south and sort of dig her out of the...
Well, Robert Hemingway, wonderful man, had written a book about her, and that's how I knew that she was buried somewhere and nobody knew where it was. And that just seemed to me shameful for all of us.
Unmarked grave.
Not just black people, but anybody who claims to believe in literature, history, that they want to know something about the country. You know, you have this great woman who's done all this anthropological work.
Unbelievable.
And written, you know, folklore, folk tales, taken down dances, I mean, you know, saved dances for us to see what people were doing. I mean, and that there were all these people who didn't know. And in fact, there was a writer who was writing about folklore in America, and one of the reasons I couldn't use his work to further study her work was that he actually said in his book that he didn't think the Negro had a big enough brain. So, you know, this is the kind of racist, insensitive, stupid, you know, stuff that people were writing, you know, in the 30s and the 20s and, you know, when...
The whole eugenics movement, the high cognitive versus the simple brain and...
Well, so anyhow, so Zora then is just this person who might have been lost to us, and we would have been so much more impoverished than we are. You know, there are all kinds of things that we, you know, generally speaking, don't know. For instance, I'm rereading a book now called Our Nig, by Harriet Wilson. And this is the first African-American novel written here in this country. And it explores in the book the relationship between a mulatto child in this household of white people and how she is severely abused, especially by the white woman in the story, I mean, in the situation. This is actually crucial for us to have as a text when we're trying to teach our children about the country, just about how people of color, slaves, enslaved beings, were treated by some of the people who, after that and even during that, pretended that they were not, you know, mistreating anyone. You know, a clarity of vision about what is a historical truth is very helpful in creating a character that knows where it is in the world. So, you know, I recommend this to whoever's listening. It's a book called Our Nig. It was discovered by Henry Louis Gates many years ago. And that is, you know, that is part of what the same Zora thing, that Zora would have been lost to us. She would have been lost. And the thing is, you need a champion. When you're smeared, as she was, you know, she was also accused of sexually abusing a 10-year-old boy. Meanwhile, she was in Honduras. He was in New York. I mean, how this was supposed to work, I don't know. But anyway, it was sensationalized in the black newspapers. And that is why she was hounded out of the North and ended up back in Florida, where she was working as a maid. You know, luckily she didn't really stay all the way down, but she was pretty crushed.
How did you actually find her? What was that journey like?
Well, lucky for me, I had this Floridian friend, a very large white woman with big shades, and we, Harriet, was it Harriet? Anyway, I can't remember exactly because, no, it wasn't Harriet. But anyway, we took out across the landscape in Florida looking, and I passed myself off as her niece because I only had a few days and I had to get back to my little child in Mississippi. And I went around and I asked, you know, where is she? What do you know? You know, where happened to her? And they had, you know, I don't know. She's over, maybe over there. So finally they said, well, one thing we do know, that she's not in the regular cemetery. She's in a field that is going to be a cemetery, but there's nobody out there but her. So, oh God, I wish I could remember her name. But anyhow, we got in her car because she was the one who had a car, and we dashed over to the, mortuary people, and you know, said, well, okay, well, just at least point us in their direction. And they pointed, you know, over yonder behind that, and we got to this field, and my companion, I'll just call her Harriet, said, I said, well, Harriet, you have to come with me because, you know, where are we? And she said, well, I'm not going with you because actually this area is really well known for snakes and big ones.
So I'll just go in there alone.
So she said, well, I'll sit here in the car and wait for you. And I thought, well, okay. So I, you know, hitched up my long, I used to wear these long skirts. So I hitched up my long skirt and I plunged in, and, you know, the weeds were, you know, hitting me in the chin and everything. And it was, you know, it was kind of tedious. But I went on out there in the middle of the field and I said, you know, how can I find in this field a grave size grave? And I thought, you know, the only thing that will work is if I just stand where I am and I call her. And that's what I did. I just started calling her, and then I started walking. And within a few steps, I fell into the grave. So, you know, then I had to go and find, you know, a mason to make the stone. You know, because I had to do all this in like a day and a half or 2 days.
And the stone went up right there?
And the stone, they didn't make it right, but they said they'd bring it out, and they did.
Yeah.
I mean, I just saw it a month ago. It's still there. But the cemetery has changed. You know, I, after all these years, now there are many people buried there. There are no weeds. You can actually see houses in the distance. The gate has her image on it. The gate to the whole cemetery is incredible. So we had a ceremony there recently. So yeah, that's kind of how that happened in shorthand.
And you have to say that their eyes are watching God is got to be one of the best things ever written in English, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean,
definitely.
Anybody who hasn't read that damn book, you know, I've read it about six times now. Yeah. I mean, it's just a glory.
It's beautiful.
And exalted in the sense of loving her community, you know, and all the people around her and, you know, the kinds of celebrations that she would later document for other cultures and other people where, you know, it mm-hmm. came out of that home life and all the rituals that they followed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just the storytelling mm-hmm. and the whole thing was, mm-hmm. Right? We could have lost that.
Well, it's called, for me, saving a world. You know, saving a world you didn't know you had. Because imagine how much more impoverished we would be if we didn't have that. And how ignorantly people, especially people of color, would have been disparaging of their own culture because they didn't understand how it held together. I mean, what it was. It was a complete fabric and that it worked, you know. It wasn't in the shreds that they were led to believe it was. It's a whole thing, and it's like the very best nutrition that you could get.
Yeah. And the anthropological, the depth of the anthropological work. And she was, am I making this up? She was the first black graduate.
At Barnard. Mm-hmm. In anthropology
under Franz Boas.
Yes.
And she took it very, she was a scientist.
Yeah.
As well as being an incredible novelist. Mm-hmm. The short stories are unbelievably mm-hmm. beautiful mm-hmm. and
free
moving.
Spirit.
Unbelievable.
Very free spirit. Yeah.
Well, we thank you for that.
That's a big thing
that you did for all of us.
It was such a joy. I had such a good time. Mm.
I've been wanting to, the truth is, that these are the first books that I really learned to read on
mm-hmm.
because I was a profound dyslexic mm-hmm. all through growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a struggle to, like, read, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Dick and Jane were my enemies mm-hmm. early on.
Oh, my goodness.
You know,
yeah.
Spot not for me.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like I was in the Turtles group.
Yeah.
And I slowly learned to read.
Mm-hmm.
And it was books like that.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, I got to learn to read a lot mm-hmm. faster because mm-hmm. I want to read a lot of these books.
Mm-hmm.
So I thank you for bringing back Zora Neale Hurston.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacific Radio. We're speaking with Alice Walker. We're celebrating the 70th anniversary of Pacifica Radio and KPFA. Alice is a fan. What else can we talk about? What else?
Oh, God, are you kidding?
I hope not.
Yeah, there's a whole of life, the whole of direction of the world. You know, there's a whole, you know, area of how do we have children in this world who avoid being indoctrinated with the idea that violence is the only way to be. I mean, the only thing to have, you know. I was watching, I'm very interested, you know, I live part of the year in Mexico, so I had managed to be there writing and quite, you know, happy and avoiding the fact that the drug situation, in fact, El Chapo himself, all that was going on, you know. And recently I've taken it on myself to take a look at that because I want to understand the suffering of some of my neighbors, you know, whose sons are being caught up and whose daughters are afraid and who's, you know, all of that. So I'm now looking at it from the American side and realizing that this way that we're teaching the young so early how to murder and how to destroy, you know, it's our nemesis. I mean, we won't survive, you know, raising children who know so easily, you know, how to put a gun together and use it. So that's some of what I've been thinking about.
The gun violence, the suffering that happens around that, now we're having sort of suicides
mm-hmm.
from people who were subjected, young people who were subjected to this kind of violence. I spent a lifetime, you know, the first two-thirds of my life were as a teacher and educator, you know, mm-hmm. even as doing this radio stuff, really making sure that I work with young people in different ways. And there's a lot of hope. But, you know, again, I'm totally troubled, and I cry a lot. Now, I have to admit that I cry a lot about these things. Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know, Alice, I think I feel a lot deeper. The older I get, the more I feel things, not the less. Mm-hmm. You know, the more I walk down the street and somebody's suffering, I start crying. It's mm-hmm. not good.
I understand.
But this is... you know, when I think about the children and the amount of time I've spent with kids and what's possible when they're comforted and given an opportunity, and then to see this and to see the cruelty in response, what the NRA is willing to do and who they own in the process, just it feels, so I don't want to say this, but it sometimes that thing feels hopeless.
I know, but we can't let it be hopeless for the children. What I would like to see among parents is more awareness about who they're bringing into the world and whether they need to do that until we have fixed it up. We've cleaned it up a lot. You know, I think if I had one central message to send out, it would be that instead of, you know, just... you know, wanting that baby so much that you're just going to have it no matter what, just take a little time to consider what you're bringing, where you're taking this baby, you know, where you're placing it. Because, you know, children are really precious. I mean, they really are. Babies are really precious. And they should not have to come into this world and try to deal with this madness. You know, I mean, and without enough human beings really giving their all to making it a good place for them to land, it's just not right. It's not fair to them. And people will say, well, I just want a baby. You know, and who wouldn't? They're wonderful. But look where they're being asked to come.
See, that's a decision I made a long time ago. That I could not bear, just based on my own amount of suffering, and as a teacher, you know, first in the South Bronx in East New York, and then in Rikers Island, seeing young people and teenagers, I just could never live with myself bringing a human being, or I couldn't take it. Let's just put it that way. If a child of mine, you know, it was hard enough for me not to strangle some people the way they treated the kids that I was teaching. Yeah. But if anybody hurt my child, mm-hmm. I just couldn't do it.
But they're hurting children all the time.
Yeah,
When I look at some of the program, I don't watch very much, but that's a bombardment that our children are suffering. They're being from very small, maybe even before they're born, they're just being indoctrinated with such an anti-human vibe, you know, that toward violence and coldness. And their little spirits, you know, are being so distorted and harmed. I think it's much more decent and much more courageous to just forego that part until we've cleaned up the planet. I mean, in all kinds of ways, at all levels, you know, just really say to ourselves, well, you know, we'll just, you know, do without this wonderful thing that a child is, until we do the work that we need to prepare for it. We need to prepare for children. We need to prepare for them. I mean, this coming in, just, you know, having them and, you know, they're just throwing them out there. No, we can't do that anymore. And expect, you know, I mean, of course people are going to do it. I mean, they won't hear a thing I'm saying. But, you know, poor things.
You know, I one of my prison experiences that stands out among others is I'm in the classroom in Rikers Island teaching for John Jay College for college credit, and one of the new students comes into the classrooms. You're in the women's house of detention. And one of my new students comes in, and he stops at the door of the classroom, and he points. He says, "Mr. B, Mr. B, dig it. I play it cool and dig all jive. That's the reason I stay alive. My motto is, as I live and learn, dig and be dug. In return, Mr. B, I remember that poem." You know, but I had him in junior high school.
Uh-huh.
He was a great poet back then. I remember he was one of the kids that wrote one of the poems that I read at the reading that we did together. I remember his poem was, "Last night I saw God's hand outside my window. When I went to touch it, it turned into pants." Okay, you got the poetry down. But he remembered that Langston Hughes poem, and, you know, and the power. Mm. So it was, you know, on the one hand, it was exalted. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he's in jail. This beautiful, brilliant kid goes from, you know, and I had a beautiful class, and I spent, you know, had this special program. So I had 10 kids that were supposedly emotionally disturbed kids. I really had a chance to teach with 10 kids and an assistant. It was an amazing program. It disappeared, of course, in the New York City school system. That was when they were shutting down all the libraries, but somehow in the schools, but somehow this class was allowed to continue. And Muriel Rukeyser, when I applied for the workshop at the 92nd Street Y, I hadn't written any poems, so I sent in my kids' poems. I said, "These are my kids' poems. I haven't written any yet, but I want to be in this workshop." Mm-hmm. And I was with 10 writers and me. She'd say something, they could write for 10 minutes straight. I'd be standing there, me and her would be looking at each other. I said, "I don't really feel like writing. I don't feel like writing much." But she began to gather books, and hundreds of books. Because I said in the workshop that, you know, I was worried they had closed down the library in my school and we needed books. That night I didn't know who she was other than this workshop, and I got a call. "Is this Dennis? This is Muriel. Dennis, I want you," I didn't know what she was talking about, "but Dennis, I want you to make me a list of all the books you can think of that you want the kids to have, and all the books you cannot think of yet that you want the kids to have, and send it to me immediately." And she began.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways,
well, I call that preparing a trying to prepare a place for the children to come, you know, because the young man that you were talking about before, who's in prison but who's a good poet, what happened was that, you know, we had not prepared a place for him to come after he left you, after he left, you know, what was supportive and green and good for him. We had not prepared as a culture, as a country. So where would these children go? I mean, there they are. They're brilliant. They're beautiful. They have good spirits. But, you know, where is the place we have prepared for them? It has not been prepared.
Well, we're going to work on that. We're out of time. Can I thank you for coming in, Alice Walker, for joining us on the 70th anniversary of KPFA and Pacifica Radio.
That does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. It's just past Easter, so this is a good time to reflect on secular holidays, Notre Dame, the Great Supermarket Strike, and how Edward Bernays got American women hooked on cigarettes. I hope you'll stay tuned. I am speaking in 2019, at Easter time, you might say. Like Christmas, Easter is a cultural holiday as well as a religious one. My nuclear family continues to celebrate the holiday, even though our religious beliefs have moved far, far away from mainstream Christianity. But Easter is the time when our remaining family in the region gets together at our house for a nice meal. Our remaining family comprises me, my lawfully wedded wife Mary, my younger son, now 21, my mother-in-law, now in her mid-90s, and Mary's older brother. I cook most of the dinners in our household, but at Easter, Mary takes over and roasts a leg of lamb. No connection to the Good Shepherd or the Lamb of God, though I suppose these religious metaphors are why lamb became a traditional dish at Easter. Why baked ham is also traditional at Easter is anybody's guess. 100 years ago, to celebrate Easter, you didn't just have a big dinner. You also bought nice new clothes. Then you paraded around in them, often literally. Remember the Easter parade? Remember the old song, I could write a sonnet about your Easter bonnet. You'll be the grandest lady in the Easter parade. Speaking of Easter, some weeks back in our show, Mark Crispin Miller was discussing that evil genius of the early 20th century, Edward Bernays. Bernays is known as the father of public relations, and I hope Satan is still keeping the thermostat up in Bernays's particular corner of hell. Woodrow Wilson, who is probably Bernays's roommate down below, Wilson hired Bernays to sell Americans a war they didn't want and didn't need, a war Wilson had pledged to keep America out of during the presidential campaign. That would be World War I. Bernays did a bang-up job at this task, selling the war. After the war, Bernays did other bang-up jobs, helping business sell products Americans didn't need and, up to that point, didn't especially want. Pianos, for instance. Mark Crispin Miller talked about some of these campaigns on our show. But Miller did not mention my favorite Bernays stunt, if favorite is the right word for it. And this connects to Easter. In the 1920s, Big Tobacco had a problem. It's the same problem that Harley-Davidson and Smith & Wesson are having and failing to solve today. In the 20s, the problem was that Big Tobacco couldn't convince half the domestic market to buy their product. Very, very few American women smoked cigarettes, even in private. And no respectable woman would even consider smoking a cigarette in public. Smoke in public? You might as well put on a red dress, stand under a street lamp, and say, "Hello, sailor," to every man who passed by. No way. Women did not want to smoke, And apparently, men did not want women to smoke either. You would think that would have settled it. Edward Bernays to the rescue. With money from Big Tobacco, he launched into a large and expensive campaign to tap into the strong feminist movement of the day. The campaign focused on women and celebrated cigarettes as torches of freedom. Then he orchestrated this. In New York City's big Easter parade of 1929, a contingent of genuine certifiable debutantes was marching along. The cream of young, elegant, high society. The debutantes stopped in front of a battery of press photographers and newsreel cameramen. Then each fair lass suddenly whipped out a cigarette and lit up her torch of freedom. In public. Take that, you old outmoded patriarchy. Yes, we've come a long way, baby. That was before they had Virginia Slims, of course, so the Debs had to make do with Philip Morris. Speaking of Slim, Bernays also launched a campaign stressing that smoking helped keep a gal thin. Starting the day after that Easter parade, cigarette sales to women took off. Women smoking in public became associated with youth, beauty, power, wealth, and emancipation. And a slim waist. On the avenue, Fifth Avenue, the photographers will snap us, and you'll find that you're in the rotogravure. And they were. And millions saw them there and bought. About 8 years after that notable Easter parade of 1929, a young woman who later became my mother started to smoke, encouraged to do so by her then-boyfriend. She died of congestive obstructive pulmonary disease in 1998. Do they still have Easter parades so people can show off the expensive new clothes they bought for the occasion? Mary says people at least do buy new clothes and then show them off in church on Easter Sunday. Either way would be fine with Jesus, right? Didn't he say, "It is easier for a rich man to buy a camel than for a poor man to crawl through the eye of a needle"? Or something like that. I'm not sure I've got the wording down exactly right. But my point is that in the West, traditional Christian holidays have become secular celebrations, too. And in America, we take it one step further. Not just secular, but commercialized to a fare-thee-well. And if the garment industry isn't getting quite the boost it used to at Easter, it's doing okay. And the lamb industry is having its best season of the year. With my help. And the florist industry and the candy industries are making a good buck off of Easter, too. So Wall Street can still say, hallelujah. And don't worry about Big Tobacco. They're doing well as usual. They got American women. Then adult women and adult men wised up and stopped smoking in droves. Not to worry, Big Tobacco will do okay. All the global free trade agreements now prevent third world countries from keeping American cigarettes out, like the countries used to. So Big Tobacco is making a bundle, selling coffin nails to Africa, Malaysia, India, Kazakhstan, you name it. Thanks, neoliberalism. And Philip Morris, technically, its holding company, Altria, has just bought a very large share of Juul, the most popular of the electronic vaping products that teenagers today love. Sure, Juul doesn't give you the nasty combustion products of burning tobacco, But you do get a nice dose of highly addictive nicotine in every cool, candy-flavored, easy-to-hide puff. You may even be able to inhale that crap in class without your teacher even noticing. E-cigarettes, today's torches of freedom. Brought to you by Philip Morris. And perhaps we owe it all to the grandest young ladies in that Easter parade. So, show your appreciation. Take a debutante to lunch, if you can afford it. I've spoken longer than I intended to about Edward Bernays and cigarettes and the secularization of Easter. Easter 1929 was supposed to be a brief introduction to the two biggest topics in the news here in Connecticut in this Easter season. Those topics are the severe damage to Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris and the strike at Stop and Shop supermarkets in southern New England. Competing with these stories was also the long-awaited so-called Mueller Report from the Justice Department. But with its apparent absence of smoking guns and its absence of judicial indictments, the Mueller report seems an anticlimax at best, and most people hereabouts seem to be tired of the whole matter, like we quickly got tired of Whitewater. Me too. I'm tired of hearing about it too. Maybe that's what the Republicans want to happen. I feel it anyway. The whole Russia sabotaged our election claim was obvious nonsense from the start. New World Notes said this much at length in January 2018 in a show featuring ex-CIA officer Philip Giraldi. Our American political elite is perfectly skilled at sabotaging and subverting our own elections without any help from the Ruskies. Thank you very much. We amply proved this in 2000, 2004, and on numerous other occasions. Listen, Democratic Party commissars, your Hillary Clinton did not lose the election because of 4,000 anti-Clinton posts on Facebook. Clinton lost the election on her own personality and her own extensive public record as a war hawk and a loyal servant of Wall Street and the big corporate interests. We had 8 years of the so-called New Democrat movement under its founder and her husband, Bill Clinton, years that brought us NAFTA, the destruction of the welfare safety net, more and more monopolies, more and more setbacks to labor unions, and, worst of all, the deregulation of the banking industry, which led directly to huge financial scams and then the collapse of the world economy in 2008. Thank you, Hillary and Bill. We tried your new democratic approach once and didn't much care for it. So, here in darkest Connecticut, the Mueller report was greeted with weary sighs. Bigger news was Notre Dame, and what's really getting us going is the supermarket strike. Well, since we're on the theme of the Easter season in New England, how about a song? Something better than my rendition of Easter Parade. That shouldn't be too hard to find. In the early 19th century, Connecticut was the home of an especially controversial Protestant Christian, John Brown. In his fine song, David Rovix compares Brown to Jesus Christ. Brown died to set men free, you see. To set enslaved black men free, and women too. Abraham Lincoln did the same. Brown's crime was trying to free the slaves prematurely. He was executed by the United States government for bad timing, you might say. One phrase repeated in the song needs to be glossed. Rovix sings of Brown riding across the Kansas prairies, Beecher's Bible in his hand. Beecher's Bible was not a book. It was a high-powered rifle. John Brown's fellow Connecticut abolitionist, the Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, secretly shipped rifles and ammunition to anti-slavery forces in Kansas. Shipped them in boxes marked books or Bibles. So the rifles were humorously referred to as Beecher's Bibles. Before the Civil War, some interesting Christians were running around Connecticut. No Easter parades for them. Here is David Rovix.
Owen Brown was an abolitionist. John was Owen's son. He grew up in New England. He was born in Torrington. John Brown was a tanner and a man of many skills. He stood up for the workers who toiled in the mills. He stood up for the Indians. He stood up for the women, for the oppressed and the exploited. This good man stood with them. So when Kansas was bleeding, he went and joined the fray. If the slave trade wanted Kansas, the slave trade would have to pay. Riding on the Kansas prairie with a fine and loyal band, glory, hallelujah, Beecher's Bible in his hand, glory, Beecher's Bible in his hand. With 2,000 of New England's best and bravest sons, Captain Brown fought in Kansas with a Bible and a gun. When Free Lawrence was on fire, lighting up the night, the border ruffians would flee. John Brown would stand and fight. Lincoln called him a fanatic, and he was a Christian who thought you could do unto others as you'd have others do unto you. Christ said, love your neighbor, and if your neighbor's held in slavery, he was one who felt his duty was to fight to set them free. Riding on the Kansas prairie with a fine and loyal band, glory, hallelujah, Beecher's Bible in his hand, glory, hallelujah, Beecher's Bible. Then went to bordering Missouri, raided the plantations, no compromise, said he. Broke the chains and shackles, rode at night to Canada. Out of this nightmare, the devil's home, America. He was caught in Harper's Ferry, his family lying dead. They questioned him for hours as he lay there and bled. They hanged him on the gallows. They laid him in his grave. John Brown was a Christian, and he died to free the slave. Riding on the Kansas prairie with a fine and loyal band, glory, Beecher's Bible in his hand, glory, hallelujah,
I don't know why, but near the end of that song, I find those church music-like cadences of the organ very, very moving. They trigger some deeply rooted yearning for transcendence, for some purpose to life in the universe other than the grubby getting and spending with which we waste most of our hours here in the human barnyard. I'm quoting Wordsworth, oddly enough. Not my favorite poet, but he got it right all through that poem. He wrote, "Getting and spending, we lay waste our powers." I felt the same yearning and sadness looking at the New York Times' fine color photographs of Notre Dame Cathedral, first ablaze and then burned, especially the big photo shot from above. I have no personal connection with the building. I've never been to France, and I have no fondness towards the Roman Catholic Church. And yet, Notre Dame's exterior alone has this stunning, uplifting beauty to it. It is soul-stirring, even to the secular. And the building is utterly irreplaceable. You can't build a building like that in the corporate capitalist world. And it's 800 years old. Here in the United States, there is very little as old as 250 years. In many parts of the country, you'd have to travel a bit to find any structure that's as old as 150 years. But 800 years. And to learn that, behind and above all those massive flying buttresses, the building is actually quite fragile. Somehow that fragility makes the cathedral seem even more endearing and precious, makes its severe damage seem even more poignant. We began this show talking about the secularization of things that were originally religious, like the Easter holiday. Secularization is the norm in modern France. That country has a long history as a Christian Catholic land, of course. Indeed, for a time it was home of one of the two competing popes the church had. The guy in Rome won, but the French still make the wine Chateau Neuf du Pape, which means the Pope's new home. Despite all its churchy history, France has become a thoroughly secular nation, much more secular than the United States at present. In France, government is entirely separate from religion. No White House prayer breakfasts there, no "In God We Trust" on the currency. The vast majority of the French people are not churchgoers and have no connection with, no love at all for, Catholic Christianity. And yet, by all accounts, the French are heartbroken at the damage to the Cathedral of Notre Dame. But of course, me too. And so are other Americans I know, even non-believers. What would the United States government do if such a misfortune happened here today? We all know the answer to that. Government spokesmen would immediately blame the Muslims and the right-to-lifers, then declare war on Venezuela, then bulldoze the cathedral's remains and any poor black or Hispanic neighborhood in the vicinity. Then it would build 11 luxury condominium buildings on the site. But as I said, the really big news this Easter season is not Notre Dame, but the supermarket strike. Stop and Shop is a big regional chain with U.S. headquarters in Massachusetts. It's actually a division of a big international corporation, Ahold, based in the Netherlands. One of the reasons I shop there is that its workers are unionized. But the union contract expired in February. Management demanded cuts in benefits in any new agreement. An outside mediator failed to help at all, and finally the workers stopped work a week before the Easter shopping spree. According to news reports, management has brought in scab replacement workers. I wouldn't know. I haven't been near my local store since the strike started. The heartwarming thing about the strike is the large amount of public support it seems to have. Just like the UPS driver's strike in 1997. Remember that? Despite the apparent conservative conformity of so many of the people here, especially here in the towns outside of Hartford, despite the pro-corporate bias of all the news media around, despite the personal inconvenience of having to find things in unfamiliar grocery stores of other chains, despite all this, public support of the strikers appears to be strong. The actual people here are in fact further to the left politically than the Democratic Party's executives are, and much further to the left than the corporate-controlled media. The media and our so-called leaders try very, very hard to prevent progressives from realizing how many of us there actually are. So it comes as a very pleasant surprise when one of us discovers we're not the only person with progressive opinions in our zip code. Right-wing though it may be, the local newspaper does publish the occasional letter from someone who lives on the same planet that I do. John H. Peretta is a stranger to me, but he had some nice things to say about the strike at the supermarket. I trust he won't object to my reading aloud a large chunk of his letter. Here is what he says. My cardiologist told me I should walk more. I decided to have my walks serve a larger purpose by walking a picket line in support of the striking Stop and Shop workers. These workers are asking for nothing more than a decent wage, along with retirement and medical benefits. A large corporation, such as the one that owns Stop and Shop, sees this as a slight inconvenience to its never-ending quest for more profits. A corporation is very much like a shark in the ocean seeking food. The shark has no sense of right or wrong when it comes to food. Neither does a corporation when it comes to profits. John H. Peretta continues, I shop at Stop and Shop because it is union. I like unions, as imperfect as they are, because they seem to be the only source for many workers to have better pay and benefits. I appreciate the benefits unions have contributed over the years. Pensions, medical benefits, better wages, job health and safety, to name a few. I developed a strong dislike for major corporations and their greed. The only way I can think of getting to them is by boycotting their places of business until they give their striking workers a fair and decent contract. I hope to be walking in the park again soon. Thank you, John, for your stirring Eastertime message. And with that epistle, we end this edition of New World Notes. This is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, and hoping you'll come back again next week. Till then.
Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On today's show, we're going to continue to discuss the relationship between the U.S. and Venezuela and what you're not being told by our government and corporate media. And as is the case with 9/11, the government and media withheld and continue to withhold key facts and evidence and push their fraudulent official story. The same thing is happening with Venezuela. For example, on February 8, 2019, President Nicolas Maduro, who, by the way, was elected last year by the Venezuelan people as their president again, he wrote a letter to the people of the United States. And to the best of my knowledge, not a single U.S. corporate media outlet has told us about this or commented on it. So I'm going to read that letter to you today. So here goes. It's called An Open Letter to the People of the United States from President Nicolas Maduro. If I know anything, it's about people, such as you. I am a man of the people. I was born and raised in a poor neighborhood of Caracas. I forged myself in the heat of popular and union struggles in a Venezuela submerged in exclusion and inequality. I am not a tycoon. I'm a worker of reason and heart. Today, I have the great privilege of presiding over the new Venezuela, rooted in a model of inclusive development and social equality, which was forged by Commander Hugo Chavez since 1998, inspired by the Bolivarian legacy. We live today in a historical trance. There are days that will define the future of our countries between war and peace. Your national representatives of Washington want to bring to their borders the same hatred that they planted in Vietnam. They want to invade and intervene in Venezuela. They say, as they said then, in the name of democracy and freedom. But it's not like that. The history of the usurpation of power in Venezuela is as false as the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It's a false case, but it can have dramatic consequences for our entire region. Venezuela is a country that, by virtue of the 1999 Constitution, has broadly expanded the participatory and protagonist democracy of the people. And that is unprecedented today, as one of the countries with the largest number of electoral processes in its last 20 years. You might not like our ideology or our appearance, but we exist and we are millions. I address these words to the people of the United States of America to warn of the gravity and danger that intend some sectors in the White House to invade Venezuela with unpredictable consequences for my country and for the entire American region. President Trump also intends to disturb noble dialogue initiatives promoted by Uruguay and Mexico with the support of CARICOM. And as a side note, CARICOM stands for the Caribbean Community, which consists of 15 countries. And now back to the letter. For a peaceful solution and dialogue in favor of Venezuela. We know that for the good of Venezuela, we have to sit down and talk, because to refuse to dialogue is to choose strength as a way. Keep in mind the words of John F. Kennedy, quote, "Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate," unquote. Are those who do not want to dialogue afraid of the truth? The political intolerance towards the Venezuelan Bolivarian model and the desires for our immense oil resources, minerals, and other great riches has prompted an international coalition headed by the U.S. government to commit the serious insanity of militarily attacking Venezuela under the false excuse of a non-existent humanitarian crisis. The people of Venezuela have suffered painfully social wounds caused by a criminal, commercial, and financial blockade, which has been aggravated by the dispossession and robbery of our financial resources and assets in countries aligned with this demented onslaught. And yet, thanks to a new system of social protection, of direct attention to the most vulnerable sectors, we proudly continue to be a charter of the United Nations, which expressly outlaws the threat of or use of force, among other principles and purposes, for the sake of peace and the friendly relations between nations. We want to continue being business partners of the people of the United States, as we have been throughout our history. Their politicians in Washington, on the other hand, are willing to send their sons and daughters to die in an absurd war instead of respecting the sacred right of the Venezuelan people to self-determination and safeguarding their sovereignty. Like you, people of the United States, we Venezuelans are patriots, and we shall defend our homeland with all the pieces of our soul. Today, Venezuela is united in a single clamor. We demand the cessation of the aggression that seeks to suffocate our economy and socially suffocate our people, as well as the cessation of the serious and dangerous threats of military intervention against Venezuela. We appeal to the good soul of American society, victim of its own leaders, to join our call for peace. Let us be all one people against warmongering and war. Long live the peoples of America. Nicolas Maduro, President of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. And again, that was an open letter to the people of the United States from President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela. And you can find a copy of that on the website globalresearch.ca, posted on February 10th, 2019. As was mentioned in last week's show, Venezuela has the world's largest oil reserves and gold deposits. And it also is rich in coltan, which is used to make cell phones. It has diamonds and other mineral resources. So that's what we're really after. It's not about humanitarian issues. And the sanctions that were put on Venezuela, as you heard Mr. Maduro mention, are what's really causing a lot of the problems in Venezuela. And here to tell us more about that is Abby Martin. And this is a recent interview she did on the Jimmy Dore show. And she has been to Venezuela and has worked for the Latin American TV program Telesur. So here she is, Abby Martin of The Empire Files.
Yeah, there's a lot of levels here. What the U.S. media always paints, the corporate media always paints, that it's a failure of these populist policies that were enacted by Chavez and further, you know, put in place by Maduro. That's completely erroneous and fallacious on its face. We can look at places like Cuba, for example, who've had a socialist policy, right, that have actually been able to export doctors around the world and has some of the, you know, lowest rates of infant mortality, et cetera. You look at the actual facts on the ground, there's several layers here. The poor people of Venezuela support the government. The elections are actually free and fair, despite the dictatorship mantra that we hear from the corporate media all the time and the political establishment. You know, you have to ask yourself why, when the Trump administration, Obama administration, and the entire neoliberal corporate media actually is behind a policy of regime change, you have to start to ask questions. Why is that? You said it yourself, Venezuela is sitting on top of the largest oil reserves in the world. They've basically been crippled with the same problem that all of Latin and South America has been, you know, ravaged by centuries of colonialism, not able to stand on its own two feet, relying too much on an import-export economy, where they basically relied too much and heavily subsidized their economy on oil exports. And so when oil plummeted, they've been trying to figure out how to get their economy back on its two feet. The problem is that the U.S. has enacted a policy of regime change since Hugo Chavez got elected in 1999. Not only did the Bush administration work with the Venezuelan opposition in order to install a bloody coup in 2003, where they kidnapped Hugo Chavez at the barrel of a gun. And actually, you saw the opposition's hand at play when that happened. They immediately installed a new constitution, and it came along with privatizing the oil at the time. So that's what we saw back in 2003. And since then, the U.S. has given $50 million to the Venezuelan opposition. Trump administration, Obama administration meets with the Venezuelan opposition members repeatedly. I like to look at Chile, Salvador Allende, back in 1973 when we installed a bloody coup. Obviously, Pinochet ruled a horrifying dictatorial rule where, you know, thousands and thousands of people were killed. The CIA had a policy of regime change there, too. Like John Perkins says, before you send in the jackals and overthrow these leaders, you try to completely destroy their economy, right? And we had a policy that said make their economy scream. That was the CIA policy in Chile back in the 70s. They're doing the exact same thing to Venezuela. And look, it's very complicated. My partner, Mike Preisner, just did a complete evisceration of John Oliver talking about just all the tired tropes about Venezuela. The economy, it's a two-sided narrative. It's either the failure of the socialist policies, they've tanked the economy, or you talk to actual Venezuelans on the ground who are in actually the barrios, the poorer areas, because this is a class warfare on its head. You talk to those poorer people and they say, look, the media is actually distorting everything. Big capitalists are actually hoarding goods. You see, it's not just socialists. There's private corporations there too. They have hoarded a lot of goods. The inflation is skyrocketing because of this hoarding, because there's an economic war being perpetrated by huge capitalists in the country. One of the CEOs controls a company called Polar. He's a Trump-esque guy who's very vehemently anti-Maduro, works openly with these opposition members with an open policy of regime change. So when I was there, I went to supermarkets. I went around to about 8 different neighborhoods, poor, middle class, wealthier, and saw with my own eyes, there is no general shortage of food. There is a shortage of particular food items. Oil, flour, very basic necessities, like that girl was saying. We don't have basic things like toothpaste, toilet paper. Why are just specific things missing, yet you can find fruit, meat, like all of these other things that you can find at a supermarket? In fact, I found paper towels and napkins, yet no toilet paper. And it becomes a little bit more clear that there are specific items being withheld, being hoarded by the capitalists, or being shipped out to Colombia, like they said, currency smuggling. There's a huge black market crisis there where you can take in a dollar bill and you get $20 off a dollar.
So let me get back to that. Polar? Yeah. Is that what it's called?
Polar.
That company, what are they withholding from the market? Do you know?
Yeah, so they actually are responsible for multiple items in the food basket that is given by the government. There's a massive economic or food subsidization program called CLAP, where the lowest and most impoverished communities are actually subsidized with food staples every month by the government. And in that food basket are the items that Polar actually produces. Now, people have argued with me and they're like, of course capitalists are not going to, you know, because there's price controls set by the government and you're expecting people to just comply with these price controls. So there's two sides of the story. But the problem is, Jimmy, that we're only getting one side. Correct. We're not getting the side that what is the U.S. doing to foment this? And it's not just the economic war being waged by these capitalists. It's the sanctions. It's the fact that the U.S. working with the Venezuelan opposition has prevented Venezuela from getting loans, being able to pay off its debt.
So what does the United States use? So when Chavez got in power, what's the rationale for now we need regime change? What did they say? That he's a dictator or that he's committing human rights violations? Or is it both those things?
So, yeah, they've always said Chavez is a dictator. You know, I always like to say the empire doesn't forgive and it doesn't forget. So when Chavez said, you know, Sulfur was here and he said a bunch of stuff about Bush that he called Bush the devil. I mean, they had a very, very tumultuous and tenuous relationship. And I think that aside from that, obviously, aside from the fact that they're sitting in the largest oil reserves in the world, it was the actual socialist policies that were put in place by Chavez that uplifted these invisible voices, people that had been rendered invisible by the oligarchs, by the ruling oligarchs for centuries in that country. I mean, we're talking about an economy that literally was on the brink of complete collapse when Hugo Chavez got elected democratically. Thousands of people were being massacred in the street. So he gets elected, basically seeing the ruins that Venezuela was going into, has millions of poor people behind him, indigenous Afro-Venezuelans, impoverished people. He gave a voice to those people that had never had one before, that were rendered invisible. And basically, that's what we're seeing today, a basic class struggle where, you know, on the streets, there's tens of thousands of people protesting against the government, predominantly white, middle class, a little bit more wealthy, tens of thousands of people supporting the government, poor Afro-Venezuelan. But what Chavez put in place, I mean, we're talking about drastic, drastic measures that basically completely uplifted the poor. I mean, cutting infant mortality. Basically, Venezuela today, still, despite this economic crisis, has the second lowest homelessness rate in the entire hemisphere.
Really?
Yeah.
So let me ask you this question. So the United States wants to overthrow the leftist government, mm-hmm. because they want to get the natural resources to a Western oil company, correct?
And it's also just seen what the policies, like uplifting poor people, and we don't like that because it put in place the pink tide. Yeah.
Because it'll be a domino effect across the Latin America and South America.
And it was. That's what we saw. We saw everyone from Bolivia, you know, we saw basically Ecuador, Korea, to Uruguay, Mujica. I mean, all of these people came into power off of this revolutionary tide that Hugo Chavez really, really did start. And the U.S. wanted to cut that at its knees.
So not unlike what happened in the 50s in Iran, there was a democratically elected president, Mossadegh, and he wanted to keep the oil for his people and export democracy mm-hmm. around the Middle East. And of course, the imperialists, the Western imperialists, the CIA and the oil companies said, that's no good. We like dictatorships because they're easier to control and democracy's messy. And by the way, you have to give us the oil. So they overthrew Mossadegh, installed the Shah, which is how we got the situation in Iran today. There was a reaction to the Shah's oppressive government, and they went to a right-wing theocratic government, which, like in America, we're going to a right-wing demagogue. So that seems like what's exactly happening in Venezuela. And so their economy is based on oil. And do you think there's anything to this theory that Saudi Arabia started to overproduce oil? And a lot of people thought it had something to do with Qatar. But it seems like they were doing that to drive down the price at the behest of the United States so they can get that oil in Venezuela. So they knew this would happen to their economy. What do you think about that theory?
I have heard that theory, and the OPEC, you know, setting prices, and also the currency exchange is set from external forces as well. So there's a lot at play. And you're totally right. I mean, the U.S. and the opposition there would rather have an undemocratic coup
yes.
and seize power than actually participate in the democratic process. And look, Venezuela is a nightmare right now. The crime is off the charts. You saw people are fleeing. It is horrible. I mean, it does cost an exorbitant amount to buy basic items, but you have to look at the bigger picture here in the context of why these things are happening. I will say one more thing. Maduro just won an election with 4 million or 5 million votes more than the next person who won. Here's what the opposition and the U.S. tried to do. Trump administration begged Venezuelan opposition to not run against him. And the opposition in Venezuela did not want to run against Maduro because they wanted to appear that it was illegitimate.
Uh-huh.
So Maduro would just run unopposed.
Right.
And then it would just bolster that narrative that, you know,
that's
he's a
smart,
dictator.
Actually. And very so, Machiavellian.
Yep. And so at the last minute, two people actually ended up running against him, which basically, you know, called bluff on the entire thing that he's a dictator. And so that's what the opposition's tactic is, to continue to try to seize power by undemocratic means. And that's why you see these violent street protests. And yes, there's tens of thousands of people protesting peacefully. However, there are violent fascistic elements where they are lynching black people for being Chavista. They're executing socialists. They are targeting basically symbols of the government's policies, maternity clinics, food distribution warehouses. I asked some guy on the front lines who was holding a pin grenade, why are you holding a grenade? And he said, I cannot be an entrepreneur in this country. And I said, I thought you guys were starving. Like, this is like, what is going on here? So the narrative starts to fall apart when you realize that the people who the U.S. exploits as the starving masses, the desperate that need us to overthrow their government, are actually the ones supporting the government.
Uh-huh.
So it's really cynical the way that these people are used.
So this whole idea of fake news, like fake news is what the mainstream news has told us about Venezuela, is what they've told us about Syria, what they told us about Libya and still do to this day. So this is the kind of thing that undermines people's trust in the media, but rightly so. Correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the media has been lockstep, and I hate to bring up John Oliver again, but you look at someone like him, and people brought him up to me because he is this pseudo-progressive voice. And so even he's repeating this bullshit.
So the way this usually ends is that they overthrow the government and the United States and the CIA install a right-wing dictator. And because all the money's that way. All the money goes that way because we can get that oil. Woo. So do you think that's – I don't mean to be a pessimist, mm-hmm. but I'm in a pessimistic mood lately. And it looks like that's probably what's going to happen, right? Especially with scenes like that and nobody in the United States knows what's going on there.
Yeah, especially when you – what kills me is that there actually is a mass famine and a country on the brink of starvation. It's called Yemen. And there's three times the amount of people who might die mm-hmm. at the end of the year that died in the Holocaust. And so to use this cynical talking point, pretend that we give about human
that's
rights.
That's hilarious, right?
It's insane. So I think Americans are a little bit smarter than that. But again, you know, we're psychologically hardwired to believe things when we see them repeated.
Yes.
So when you just see Venezuela propaganda wall to wall saying the same things, it's really hard to break through that and say, hey, actually, there's another side of the story that you're actually not getting from any progressive media at all. So thank you for covering this. And, you know, a lot of people have just totally failed. And I think that the most amazing point is that sanctions do exactly as they're intended to do. They exacerbate the crisis and they actually make food and medicine harder to get. So to put sanctions on them, we're going to use whatever the effects of those sanctions are to then install regime change later on. And it just is a vicious cycle that we have to stand up and say no more.
And again, you were just listening to part of a recent clip from an interview on the Jimmy Dore show with Abby Martin of the Empire Files. And the full interview can be found on YouTube. Just look for the Jimmy Dore show, and that's D-O-R-E. The Trump administration is now trying to send what they're calling humanitarian aid to Venezuela through the Colombian border. The Venezuelan government doesn't want the aid. And think about it. Would you want, quote, aid from a country that has admitted that it wants your oil and that has tried to oust you as president by having Juan Guaido announce himself president? And now you're going to hear a few short clips from an RT program that might indicate why the Venezuelan government does not want this humanitarian aid.
Washington's efforts in the South American country are led by Elliot Abrams. His appointment as the U.S. envoy to Venezuela has surprised many, given his previous track record in Latin America. Back in 2002, Abrams was the suspect architect of a coup attempt in Venezuela. While in the 1980s, then a member of the Reagan administration, he funneled weapons through Iran to Nicaraguan right-wing rebels. He was also accused of using humanitarian aid planes to disguise weapons shipments to militias.
We have to consider that Trump's czar, who's in charge of his Venezuelan policy right now, is Elliot Abrams, who pioneered the strategy of using humanitarian aid as a disguise for delivering weapons to U.S. proxy forces, first during the wars on Central America, the proxy wars, during which Elliot Abrams was overseeing several death squads and their genocidal humanitarian violations. The Venezuelans see this aid delivery, especially in the light of Abrams' history of using aid as a cover for delivering arms to proxy forces, as a violation of Venezuelan sovereignty, as an actual U.S. invasion of Venezuela. And so in many ways, this is seen as a Trojan horse for U.S. invasion.
As you heard earlier on the program, Elliot Abrams was behind the 2002-2003 attempted coup against Hugo Chavez, but his military backed him. So even though he was taken away out of the country temporarily, his military brought him back. And the Venezuelan military repeatedly says that they support President Maduro. And the other countries that also support Nicolas Maduro are Russia and China, along with 50 other countries. But those two big ones could lead to really potential problems if the U.S. decides to use a military approach in Venezuela. So if you would like to support groups that are working on no war on Venezuela and hands off Venezuela, no sanctions, no coup, no war on Venezuela, this coming Saturday, February 23rd, there's going to be a demonstration in New Haven. It's on the New Haven Green on the corners of Elm and Church Street, and it starts at noon right there this Saturday, February 23rd, and they will be marching to Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro's office at 59 Elm Street. You can learn more about it by writing to the Greater New Haven Peace Council at grnhpeacecouncil@gmail.com. So grnhpeacecouncil@gmail.com for more information on that. But again, it is this Saturday, February 23rd at noon on the New Haven Green on the corners of Elm and Church Street. Hands off Venezuela. And there's also going to be a national march on Washington, D.C., on March 16th to say hands off Venezuela. And you can learn more about that on the website popularresistance.org. And again, that's popularresistance.org. And the date for that march again is on March 16th. And I want to remind people that it was the Venezuelan government that donated millions of dollars of fuel assistance over many years to poor North Americans, that's like us here in the U.S., when our own oil companies refused to do so. And I also want to remind you that 9/11 wake-up call shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And again, that's the digit 4, so radioforall.net. And once on the site, click on Contributors and then look for my name, Cheryl, with a C, and the show should pop up in chronological order. And I'll end the show today with these sentiments from journalist Abby Martin.
Going to Venezuela firsthand made me realize how much the media is lying to us about the reality on the ground. The U.S. government and its propaganda arms say it's a dictatorship where mass famine and civil unrest demands U.S. intervention. They deliberately don't tell you key facts. An economic war being waged inside by private businesses and outside of the country by crushing U.S. sanctions. Trump's sanctions have debilitated the Venezuelan economy, costing them $6 billion just in the last year. And sanctions do exactly as they're intended to do, by hitting the poor and working class people the hardest. Their strategy is to starve the people into submission, then cynically use that humanitarian crisis as the premise for more intervention. They say that millions of people are demanding the ouster of Maduro. What they deliberately don't show you are the millions who support Maduro, who voted for him, who are also in the streets protesting this criminal coup attempt. They say that a coup is democracy, that Guaido is restoring the Constitution by declaring himself president in a country that just held a presidential election last year. We've seen this propaganda playbook before, from Latin America to the Middle East, and it's literally being led by the same war criminals. John Bolton, who lied us into war with Iraq, Elliot Abrams, who facilitated a genocide in Guatemala. 1 million Iraqis died for a war based on lies, paid by the so-called free press. They're doing it again. All progressives and anti-interventionists have to stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Venezuela to defend their sovereignty and let them decide their own future, free from U.S. sanctions and intervention. We must call this what it is, an illegal coup underway by the bloodthirsty Trump regime to overthrow one of the last remaining independent nations in Latin America and plunder their oil. Trump has already threatened military intervention. Millions of lives are at stake. We need your voice now to speak up and speak out against another U.S. war for oil. Hands off Venezuela.
If not you, then who? This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
I have a dream.
Healthcare.
One day.
Justice. Healthcare. Justice.
America of the people. America by the people. America for the people. Which people are you talking about? Are you talking about the wealthy with the means to stay healthy while 47 million go without? No doubt, we need a revolution. It's time for a brand new healthcare solution. Sing it on behalf of the uninsured, because I believe it's so absurd for America, the so-called greatest nation, to be in a healthcare crisis situation.
And oh, yes, we are. Think about it. Think about it. One in five people living in the U.S. are grappling with medical debt. Nearly 50% of all credit card debt in the U.S. is from medical debt. Medical debt contributes to 60% of all bankruptcies in America. And more than 40% of Americans won't be able to cover an emergency expense of $400. Here now to sow the seeds further for our discussion coming up with co-founder and director, educator, and outreach, rest in peace, medical debt, Jerry Aston, is the comedian, writer, producer, political commentator, actor, and television host, John Oliver.
It is pretty clear by now, debt buying is a grimy business and badly needs more oversight. Because as it stands, any idiot can get into it. And I can prove that to you because I'm an idiot and we started a debt buying company. And it was disturbingly easy. Let me explain. Back in April, we spent $50 to incorporate a debt acquisition company online in Mississippi. And incidentally, over the internet is the best way to experience Mississippi. We called it Central Asset Recovery Professionals, or CARP, after the bottom-feeding fish. I became chairman of the board, and CARP set up this very bland website and dipped our toes into the debt market. And with little more to go on than that website, we were soon offered a portfolio of nearly $15 million of out-of-statute medical debt from Texas at a cost of less than half a cent on the dollar, which is less than 60 grand. For that amount, CARP would be sent the personal information, including names, current addresses, and social security numbers of nearly 9,000 people. So we bought it. Which is absolutely terrifying, because it means if I wanted to, I could legally have CARP take possession of that list and have employees start calling people, turning their lives upside down over medical debt they no longer had to pay. There would be absolutely nothing wrong with that, except for the fact that absolutely everything is wrong with that. And that is why we actually decided to go another way, because we thought, well, instead of collecting on the money, why not forgive it? Because on one hand, it's obviously the right thing to do, but much more importantly, we'd be staging the largest one-time giveaway in television show history. Because as best we can tell, the most anyone has ever given away on a TV show at one time to date was this. Giveaway was worth nearly $8 million, but we bought nearly twice that in medical debt. So instead of having the file sent to CARP, we had the seller send it directly to a non-profit organisation which specialises in forgiving medical debt with no tax consequences for the debtor. And tonight, at my signal, with the power vested in me as chairman of the board of CARB, they will commence the debt forgiving process. So what do you say? Are you ready to make television history? Let's do this! Now, clearly, this is only going to help the 9,000 people whose medical debt we bought. The larger issue is we need much clearer rules and tougher oversight to protect consumers from potentially predatory companies like the one that we set up. But in the meantime, it seems the least we can do with this debt that I cannot believe we are allowed to own is to give it away. So are you ready to do this? Yeah! You are about to watch me give away $15 million. Oprah!
The one and only John Oliver. Well, from John Oliver to Jerry Ashton, a 40-year veteran and responsible member in the credit and collections industry. Does that sound like an oxymoron? Well, we're about to find out. Hell no. Well, Jerry Ashton's rest in peace medical debt has its origins in, of all place, interesting, Occupy Wall Street. Ashton's office overlooked the park, Zuccotti Park, right, where social activists camped out in 2011 to protest income inequality and seek solutions. When people associated with the Occupy movement launched a project to buy debt and erase it, Ashton offered his experience that turned that project into RIP medical debt in 2014. And I should say, just as you've heard, John Oliver actually gave the nonprofit $60,000 to purchase $15 million in medical debt and wipe it out. And Jerry, what a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, well, that's a fantastic lead in. You're talking about two of my favorite subjects, my RIP medical debt's patron saint, John Oliver. We're going to be building a statue to that guy eventually. And, of course, Occupy Wall Street, which is where my abilities, my background, my experience as a bill collector, debt collector, and my partner, Craig Antico, his experience as a debt buyer and debt collector. We were employed by the Rolling Jubilee to be their back office.
Well, now, wait, let me stop you there, because not everybody knows what Rolling Jubilee is. And then I want to get quickly from there into an actual description of what RIP medical debt does, which is amazing, amazing, and why it's so important. So Rolling Jubilee?
Okay, Rolling Jubilee was an outgrowth of the belief that occupiers had that there were economic discrepancies that had to be brought to the attention of the public. And what better way than to go into this debt market that John Oliver mentioned, purchase debt for pennies on the dollar, and then very, very publicly forgive that debt to bring attention to not only healthcare issues, but every other social issue that was coming out of Occupy Wall Street. So they discovered that I was in their midst as a bill collector. And the way they discovered that is because every time someone would come up telling me about being chased by a bill collector, I'd have some advice. And I was part of the student loan group, student loan debt. I gave them advice. So when they discovered that, we got together. They made a decision that we would very quietly in the background serve them to get that word out. They raised eventually over $700,000, and all by themselves, with our help, they abolished over $40 million worth of medical debt, student loan debt, payday loan debt, bail bond debt, all the things that you and I consider to be, shall we say, predatory in many ways.
Now, RIP medical debt has worked for 4+ years in its existence to accept public donations with which to go to the debt market to purchase over $500 million in unpaid and unpayable medical debt, only to forgive those debts. Now, let's get into how this industry works to begin with, and this phenomenal project to forgive this debt. And a debt which shatters, absolutely shatters people's lives. So how does that industry work, and what the hell is wrong with our medical system that brings people to the brink of foreclosure, bankruptcy, absolute disaster? And then how your charity steps in, which evolved from Occupy, this phenomenal project that can save literally the lives of tens of thousands of people.
Well, before we get into the details of how that debt is created, which is unconscionable, the way that that debt is created, we need to understand that we have to educate ourselves. Even as a bill collector, I was unusual in the sense that I would only work for clients that were ethical, and I wouldn't work any accounts that I felt were unable to pay. It just didn't make not only economic sense, but moral sense. So I was already in that direction, so to speak. That's where my head was. But it wasn't until Occupy that I became educated as to the impact of what it means to a family to have a serious illness or an accident. Overnight, you and I are one accident, one illness away from financial disaster. So as part of learning and becoming educated, that's when it touched us. It touched me, Craig, and our third partner, Robert Goff. It touched us in such a fashion that when the Rolling Jubilee and Occupy began to dissipate and they were no longer going to do that, we looked at each other and we said, this can't happen. And so then we set about learning more and more and more, which I'm going to insist that your listeners do, which is to learn to become powerful about things like this. So when we learn more and more about what we can do and how we could do it, the next step was action. And in our case, number one, it was creating a 501c3 called RIP Medical Debt on July 25th, 2014. And then Robert Goff and I wrote a book a year later called The Patient, the Doctor, and the Bill Collector, which is basically a survival guide for people. And then just last December, the three authors, three of us, wrote a book called End Medical Debt, Curing America's $1 trillion in unpayable healthcare debt. So it's all about being educated. Become, first, you get aware. That's what Occupy did. It made people aware. Then it touched people. And a lot of people that showed up, a lot of people that supported Occupy, supported what we were doing there. Then it was education, where people really need to educate themselves more and become more powerful, which is why Occupy has morphed into so many amazing organizations doing such great things. And then, of course, action. Well, in our case, that action is every penny is worth a dollar, every dollar is worth $100, and every $15,000 creates a campaign that will abolish over $1 million worth of medical debt. How's that for having fun and doing good?
Well, I'm feel like I'm on a roller coaster here because I don't really understand how in the world do you get people to make the contributions we saw through John Oliver, but to make the contributions to do this. And how the hell does this debt build up to begin with? I mean, how does this work, and why is it so important to get this debt monkey off of people's back?
Well, we're going to find out in one way, because RIP Medical Debt attracted the attention of four major universities that are right now working to do an economic impact study of what it means to take a medical bill off the kitchen tables of mom and dad, you and me. And this, these four universities, UC Berkeley, UCLA, MIT, and the University of Chicago, when they saw what they were doing, they said, now this is a way to have evidence-based proof that indeed medical debt ravages our society and costs everybody money. But if you want to know the life cycle of how this happens, we're the only industrial nation that does not have universal health care for its citizens. The only one. The only one that will allow people to go bankrupt because they got sick or injured. 15 million people today in America this year will exhaust their life savings to cover medical expenses. So that's an egregious wrong, and more people are becoming, number one, aware, number two, are being touched, number three, are educating themselves, and number four, are taking action. So when you get that illness or accident, you go to the hospital, hopefully you're fixed up and you're sent home, and then the bills start arriving. You may or may not have insurance. Even if you have insurance, and by the way, over 60% of all the people who declare bankruptcy have medical debt insurance, have medical insurance, and still go bankrupt. So the bills start coming in because you cannot pay, no matter how much you want to pay. Then they get tired of sending bills and calling you directly. They send it out to a collection agency. The collection agency is assigned those accounts and proceeds to pursue them on a contingency basis. Means if they catch it, they get a share of what they bring back. Well, these statistics are terrible. First of all, at least up to a third of all the accounts that are sent out to collection agencies shouldn't have gone there to begin with, either because of errors in billing, or it could be even the wrong person being charged for a procedure. That's happened many times. Out of network doctors, which, by the way, have been created by the insurance industry, that tells you who you can see and who will cover you for what they'll pay. So when all these things start happening to you, the patient, you're not any longer a patient. You're a profit center, and they're going to do their best to get that money out of you. After all, the goods and services were delivered. Where's the money? Well, if you can't pay it because our government has decided that they'd rather spend money elsewhere, you are up a creek without
a paddle. And Jerry, let me just ask you, let's put a face on it. Who are some of these entities that buy up and profit off of the debt that accrues as a result of a miserable healthcare system, not the actual health care, but the system of provision, which can rip the gut out of people financially, for sure?
Well, it's a stretch to call ours a system. It's not a system. It's a disparate part that are plugged together, and each one of them requiring you to step up and take care of the cost, which means that someone who's profit-oriented is going to want to be part of that chain of pain, as I call it. If you take a look at a legal industry, they have every right in the world, just like people buy up mortgages and collateralize them. People buy up credit card debt, and they collateralize it, and then they start collecting on it. This is a legitimate industry which shouldn't have to exist when it comes to health care. 50% of all collection activity in America is health care related. If we were to have no medical bills created, then you and I would have to pay, because we would have paid in over time as citizens, just like we do with Social Security or Medicare. If we took that medical debt portfolio away from the collection industry, 250,000 people would be out of a job. That gives you an idea of the extent. Now, in the debt, if you want to know about the debt buyers, well, they go to a hospital. They say, I see you have $100 million worth of unpaid bills there. You've got your own bills to pay. You've done your best. Why don't you sell it to us? We'll give you 3 or 4 or 5 cents on the dollar. So a hospital CFO will look at $100 million worth of nothing versus $5 million worth of something and makes an intelligent business decision. And that's when your account, the one that went to collection agencies and was finally returned to the hospital, that's when it gets into the system that John Oliver described.
So let's talk about your charity. How does it function? This is amazing. This is so benevolent and amazing to me. We're talking about, and I believe it's probably even more now, that you've purchased over $500 million in debt And yes, you've correct. Been able to forgive it. So the process yes. of getting philanthropic monies to buy up this debt and what it means, again, just give us a kind of case study of an individual who has been able to benefit from this phenomenal RIP forgiveness of medical debt charity that you set up as inspired by the Occupy movement.
Well, if you go to our website, ripmedicaldebt.org, there will be the story. You'll also see the latest amount of monies that we've raised and the amount of debt that we've forgiven.
And by the way, how much have you raised and forgiven?
Well, so far, we've raised enough money to have forgiven over $600 million worth of medical debt, and our goal is $1 billion. So I think we're going to achieve that this year. And here's where you have to thank. Here's who you have to thank, you and me. Americans are the most generous people at all, of all, it seems. We are always ready there, if we can afford it, to be able to step in and help somebody. But medical debt is so huge that nobody, no single individual, can help that many people. So we walked into the picture where this debt has gone through the process of being bought and sold, and we want to stop that from happening. We want to take that account off the desk of a bill collector. So we pay the same amount of money that a debt buyer would, a debt collector would pay for that debt. And the difference is, as you pointed out, when we get that debt in our hands, we forgive it. We slit his throat. It's gone. You'll never get another call from a bill collector again. So it's because of people like you and me and major philanthropists. Big people with big hearts as well as big paychecks have stepped up to enable us to do the work we're doing. One couple, an anonymous couple, donated last year over $2 million in order to see that $50 million worth of veterans' unpaid medical debt would be taken care of, and another $150 million worth of debt would be taken care of over Christmas and over the holidays and over Thanksgiving. And they wanted to let people know that this did not exist. And that was how they got a lot of publicity.
I want to, just because time keeps marching on, to also talk about the newest book that you were one of three co-authors, and medical debt. That's another issue and component part, and grows out of your general feeling and understanding about the crushing effect, both in terms of the society and the toll it takes, and most definitively the individual's medical debt. So tell us about End Medical Debt, which is the first book I know of to bypass kind of political posturing to look clearly and realistically at actual causes and possible cures for more than what you said is $1 trillion in unpayable medical debt in America.
Well, you know, chance and providence wouldn't have it any other way than to get a couple of reformed bill collectors, myself and Greg Antico, and Robert Goff, who was the former executive director of the NYU Physicians Association and has a distinguished background in healthcare and hospitals. You had to bring, and a maverick himself, you had to get these three people together to give people a real view of what's going on, not posturing, not politicizing it, but just saying, this is it. This is how it's come about. And these are the solutions. And each one of us has a different voice. We argue amongst ourselves just as much as any other citizen would about what's the right way and the wrong way. But between all three of us, or amongst us, a reader can get in there and have a balanced view of how did it start, who are the villains, where does the money go, and by the way, always follow the money. And, of course, the solutions. So I would be delighted to have people educate themselves. And every time you do go to Amazon and purchase it, enough, because all three authors have donated our royalties to RIP medical debt, every purchase also abolishes $500 worth of medical debt. How's that for getting smart and doing good at the same time?
I think it's great. But this is so fantastic. This is so fantastic. Unfortunately, time is drawing to a close. So I want you to just take us out with what you think are the major contributions. Obviously, education. But education about what on the book and medical debt. And then, of course, people need to go to the RIP Medical Debt website, whether they specifically need assistance and or want to make contribution to this. I mean, think about it again. We have 1 in 5 people in the U.S. who are grappling with medical debt. 1 in 5, and nearly 50%, as I said earlier, of all credit card debt in the U.S. is from medical debt. And this is crushing to our populace. So the major points that are raised in end medical debt.
Well, you've done a better job of capitalizing it than I could. The reality is, it's up to us. The reality is, we cannot expect people who are so-called legislators, who are really influenced more by the lobbyists than they are by our vote. They need to hear from us. We intend to be in Washington, D.C., and make some noise about this as book writers, as authors, and to draw attention to this egregious infliction of pain and economic distress on Americans, because we're unwilling to collectively share in the understanding that we are all connected, we're all brothers and sisters, and healthcare is a universal right.
Well, Jerry Ashton, we are so grateful for the work that you do. I really want to encourage people, whether they need help and or whether they want to make a contribution, to go to, you can just Google RIP medical debt. You'll find it there. The organization that's worked for several years now to accept public donations, which go to the debt market to purchase over, as I said, $500 million in unpaid and unpayable medical debt, only to forgive those debts. And do get the book. Do get the book. End medical debt. Because in our fervent public debates about that broken U.S. healthcare system, we have overlooked the devastating impacts of America's urgent medical debt crisis. The time has come to bring medical debt into the center of our national conversation about healthcare. Jerry, thank you for your benevolence, your creativity, using a skill. And I must admit, I'm also totally turned on by seeing in the aftermath of Occupy, for people who think it just kind of sputtered and died, some of which was the outgrowth of this tremendously inspired movement, the Occupy movement. Jerry A. Ashton, thank you for spending time with us this morning.
My absolute pleasure.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out. Did you know, when you rolled back the guidance, that the stress of harassment and discrimination can lead to lower attendance and grades as well as depression for transgender students? Did you know that when you rolled back the guidance?
I do know that.
This is going to be intergenerational. People think the older people are going to help the young people. But you know, the young people have as much, perhaps more, to offer in some areas.
You just have to do it. You just have to start and do it.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Trump's military trans ban takes effect. U.S. Education Secretary DeVos flunks trans teen protections. And LA's new queer castle keeps young and old together. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Laura Dickinson-Turner.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending April 13th, 2019. U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted in July 2017 that transgender recruits should not be allowed to serve in the nation's armed forces. Even as challenges to the ban continue to be argued in federal courts, Trump finally got what he wanted this week. The last of four injunctions preventing the implementation of the ban fell in mid-March, and the Pentagon then announced that the new policy would become effective on April 12th. While Defense Department officials steadfastly insist that it's not a ban, a transgender person under the new policy can now only serve if they pretend they're not. All enlistees must now serve in their birth gender and can't transition while serving. Current transgender troops have, in some cases, been on active duty since the Obama administration lifted obstacles to their service in 2016. The Palm Center studies LGBTQ people in the U.S. military. Their research says that some 14,700 qualified and honorably serving transgender military personnel will be kicked out under the new policy unless they agree to serve as the gender they were assigned at birth. According to the Palm Center, less than 1,000 who've already transitioned or are in the process will qualify to continue serving under what are called grandfather exemptions, which could be revoked at any time. Palm Center Director Aaron Belkin wrote the book on the rise and fall of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He compared that policy to the newly instituted trans ban on MSNBC's The Rachel Maddow Show.
This is Don't Ask, Don't Tell for transgender troops, and the Trump administration is claiming that this is just an innocuous policy. It won't harm the troops, but that's what we were told at the beginning of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and we saw how well that worked out. This policy will fail in the same way that Don't Ask, Don't Tell failed, because the public won't tolerate a policy that hurts the troops indefinitely. But we can't predict now whether the collapse of the policy will be in court or in Congress, where there's now bipartisan legislation to protect the troops, or perhaps if the White House changes hands. But there's just no way to predict right now how this ban will crumble.
Virtually every U.S. Medical and Mental Health Association has rebutted Trump's claims that health care costs for trans troops would be tremendous. And before the arrival of Donald Trump, the Pentagon's own study had concluded that trans troops were not disruptive and were not causing a morale problem, as the president has claimed. The transgender military memo was signed by Acting Deputy Secretary of Defense David L. Norquist. It prohibits service members who exhibit gender dysphoria, the condition of experiencing a distressing clash between one's experienced gender and the gender assigned at birth. As BuzzFeed's Dominic Holden writes, gender dysphoria is, for many, the essence of being transgender. The U.S. military has been the country's largest single employer of transgender people, until now, of course. Qualified transgender people are welcome to serve in the armed forces of Australia, Austria, Belgium, Bolivia, Canada, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Estonia, Finland, France, Germany, Ireland, Israel, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Spain, Sweden, and the United Kingdom, and under some circumstances in Cuba and Thailand.
A court in Russia has ruled that a printing company illegally fired a trans woman in 2017 who had worked there for more than 10 years before she started to identify as a woman. The company told the Frunzensky District Court in St. Petersburg that Anna Grigorieva was fired under a 19-year-old Russian government policy that bars women from working in more than 450 jobs deemed too dangerous or arduous for women. The United Nations said in a 2016 declaration that the policy violates women's rights. The district court ordered the printing company to give Grigorieva her job back, to pay her the equivalent of about $150 in damages and about $25,000 in back pay. Her lawyer, Maxim Olenichev of the queer rights group Coming Out, announced that, for the first time in Russia, a transgender person has managed to defend her labor rights in court. He said the landmark ruling should inspire other trans people to fight for their employment rights. Ksenia Mikhailova, another lawyer for Coming Out, said the off-limits jobs are meant to ensure women's ability to conceive and give birth. She added that Grigorieva's court victory was not only a historic decision for trans people, but also for women who don't want children.
The Australian state of Tasmania has become one of the most progressive places on earth for transgender people. Its parliament passed sweeping legislation to protect them on April 10th by a vote of 13 to 12, even though the governing Liberal Party opposed it as legally untested and highly problematic. Speaker Sue Hickey joined opposition Labour and Green MPs to pass it. The legislation removes the requirement for surgery before a person aged 16 or older can change the gender designation on their birth certificate, and instead allows a simple declaration to make the change. The new laws also allow people to remove gender markers from birth certificates if they so choose, and allows parents the right to choose whether or not to include a gender marker on their child's birth certificate. The legislation bans hate speech and offensive language based on gender identity or expression, or based on intersex status. The new laws also end the requirement for married transgender partners to divorce before they can change the gender on their birth certificate. Tasmanian Families for Transgender Kids spokesperson Candice Harrington said that parents of transgender and gender-diverse kids are just so happy that our kids will no longer face legal discrimination and will be able to live their lives true to themselves. We are over the moon about these landmark reforms.
In other news, the Cayman Islands Court of Appeal shut down the planned wedding on April 10th of successful lesbian litigants Chantel Day and Vicky Bodden-Bush. The appeals court bowed to the government's request after it filed its challenge to issue a stay to prevent Chief Justice Anthony Smella's Grand Court marriage equality ruling from taking effect. 2 days before the stay was issued, hundreds of LGBTQ people and their supporters in the capital of Georgetown held a first-ever Cayman Islands Out of Our Shells Pride March. The peaceful and colorful procession ended at the steps of the Legislative Assembly, where lawmakers had applauded the announcement that the government would be appealing the marriage equality ruling. The event was organized by Colors Cayman, the island's queer advocacy group. Their statement said that, "We are proud to acknowledge our existence and hold our heads high. No longer will we be made invisible." The Court of Appeal will hear the government's challenge to the marriage equality ruling in August.
The boycott of Brunei has now been joined by the English National Ballet, the Make-A-Wish Foundation, Tempest Magazine, Citigroup, Barclays, Goldman Sachs, Jefferies, Nomura, Britain's Foreign Secretary, and the Police Federation of England and Wales. They add to the growing list of companies, celebrities, and governments that are shunning the tiny, Muslim-majority East Asian nation. It's all in response to the institution of severe Sharia, or Islamic law, by its ruling sultan. Sharia punishes consensual adult same-gender sex, adultery by Muslims, and other so-called crimes with death by stoning. The family of Sultan Hassan al-Bolkiah owns several high-end hotel properties, including the Dorchester in London and the Beverly Hills Hotel in California. You can see the entire list at thiswayout.org. Australian media this week identified Brisbane's Royal on the Park as another of the sultan's hotels. According to the travel industry publication TTR Weekly, subsidiaries of the Sultan's companies own hotel properties in Bali and Singapore as well. TripAdvisor deleted reviews for the Sultan's hotels on its platform following a spike in negative posts. Trivago, Expedia US, Expedia UK, Orbitz, and Travelocity have been condemned for continuing to take bookings for them. The Sultan also has a financial stake in Royal Brunei Airlines. Street demonstrations outside Brunei government offices have been held in London, Brisbane, and Bangkok, and more are expected. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison was the latest this week to join the global chorus of condemnation, while U.S. President Donald Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have been conspicuously silent.
And finally, you may recall A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo, an illustrated children's book published last year by TV political humorist John Oliver. It parodied a children's book by the family of U.S. Vice President Mike Pence about their real-life pet rabbit. Oliver's Last Week Tonight staff writer, Jill Twiss, actually penned the book in which Marlon meets and marries his male bunny boyfriend. A very Mike Pence-like stink bug is the villain of the story. According to the latest list from the American Library Association, or ALA, A Day in the Life of Marlon Brando was last year's second most challenged book. A majority of the top 10 books that were banned or moved to obscure library bookshelves had LGBTQ themes. The book most objected to was George, an award-winning coming-of-age story of a transgender girl by Alex Gino. Two of the children's books on the ALA's most censored list were notoriously burned outside the local public library in Orange City, Iowa last year by a far-right Christian preacher to protest the area's first LGBTQ pride event. The library received more than 200 queer-themed books and monetary donations in response. In this week's media release about the most banned books, the ALA made mention of that book burning with a quote by famed English poet and essayist John Milton, "He who destroys a good book kills reason itself."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending April 13th, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast.
And now you can be the first on your blog to hear News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out Radio YouTube channel. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Laura Dickinson Turner.
Opened up their first headquarters in 1971 with $35 in the bank. Today, we've opened up a $141.5 million campus.
This is a remarkable, remarkable dream come true.
You're invited to a historic housewarming later in the program. U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos came before Congress fresh from being publicly shamed by President Donald Trump over her department's plan to eliminate funding for the Special Olympics. Answering questions at an April 10th hearing of the House Education and Labor Committee, DeVos was pushed into another embarrassing admission by Representative Suzanne Bonamici of Oregon, who chairs the Civil Rights Subcommittee. Bonamici asked the education secretary about her decision to roll back Obama-era discrimination protections for transgendered students. DeVos tried to use the U.S. Office for Civil Rights, or OCR, as her shield, but that was no match for Bonamici's sword, and no match for a Randy Rainbow song parody either.
Cruella DeVos, Cruella DeVos. Of basic brain function, she suffers a loss. She might be even dumber than her boss. Cruella DeVos. Where kids are concerned, she'll proudly admit, if they're underprivileged, she don't give a Our education system screwed because of Betsy Cruella DeVos. She can't be bothered learning information.
I'm not familiar with that.
You couldn't fill a thimble with her thoughts.
Well, so
her paychecks? Souvenirs. She bathes in teachers' tears and burns up school supplies to fuel her yachts. She steps on the poor to boost VIPs. In her own profession, she's earned no degrees. So hide your children if you come across Cruella, Cruella DeVos.
We know that transgender students are frequently bullied and victimized. We know also that the 2016 guidance to schools about transgender students was applauded by education experts, healthcare experts, educators, counselors, pediatricians, psychologists, because it made students safer at school. But your department rolled back that guidance, creating uncertainty and concern. So I have two questions. When you rolled back that guidance, did you know that the stress of harassment and discrimination can lead to lower attendance and grades, as well as depression and anxiety for transgender students? Did you know that?
Congressman, OCR is committed to ensuring all students have equal access to education free from discrimination.
I would really like an answer. Students and families need to know this. We had a mother of a transgender student here yesterday. We need to know this. Did you know when you rolled back the guidance that the stress of harassment and discrimination can lead to lower attendance and grades as well as depression for transgender students? Did you know that when you rolled back the guidance?
I do know that, but I will say again that OCR is committed to ensuring that all students...
She's got no time for public education. She's out of touch and lacks all basic skills. She buys all her careers. She lies through her veneers and blows her nose with $100 bills.
Everybody!
She's callous and cruel, synthetically sweet. Unethical, shameless, aloof, and elite.
This song's too short to list all of the flaws. Of Betts, I mean Cruella DeVos. She's so dumb.
That's it.
That's not enough for Betsy DeVos. NBC News reported late last week that the education secretary has been working to make it easier for for-profit colleges to garner massive amounts of federal money by victimizing veterans and other low-income students. You can find Cruella DeVos and other Randy Rainbow parodies at randyrainbow.com.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis.
I'm Margaret Cho.
This is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm Kate Quinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
I'm Clive Barker.
This is Judy Shepard.
Hello, this is Ian McKellen.
I'm Joey Jewell.
I'm Stephen Fry.
I'm Harvey Milk.
Hi, this is Janice Ian.
My name's Robbie Rogers.
This is Essex Hemphill.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
I'm Tab Hunter.
I'm Billy Bean.
This is John Cameron Mitchell.
Hello, I'm Bruce Valange.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson.
I'm Robbie Kaplan.
I'm Andrew Sullivan.
This is Augustine Burroughs.
I'm Barney Frank.
I'm Cleve Jones.
My name is Kate Kendall.
I'm Dan Savage.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, and you've discovered
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
The international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
How dare they?
Now I'm fascinated.
And those who love them.
Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
And that's the truth.
May God's blessing keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you. May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung. May you stay.
A huge Hollywood block party celebrated the ribbon cutting at the world's queerest dream house come true. And This Way Out was there to share a toast.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer. On Sunday, April 7th, 2019, the Los Angeles LGBT Center celebrated the opening of the first phase of its Anita Mae Rosenstein campus, a two-acre complex in Hollywood, California, designed to serve LGBTQ youth and seniors, making it the first intergenerational LGBTQ facility in the world. The campus includes 100 beds for homeless youth, a new senior community center, a youth drop-in center, and the Ariadne Getty Foundation Youth Academy. I was interested in how this achievement might resonate with listeners across the globe listening to This Way Out in towns large and small, some with no services to the LGBTQ community at all. I spoke to Lori L. Jean, CEO of the Los Angeles LGBT Center, Anita Mae Rosenstein, the lead donor, Ari DeSano, Los Angeles LGBT Center staff member, City of West Hollywood Council members John Duran and John Heilman, Bishop Clemens, a veteran gay activist who was in the neighborhood when the Stonewall riot broke out, David Park Epstein, a veteran LGBTQ activist, and actress and activist Lily Tomlin. We begin with Lori L. Jean.
Our founders opened up their first headquarters in 1971 with $35 in the bank. Today we've opened up a $141.5 million campus. And it just goes to show what a determined group of people with great allies like Anita Mae Rosenstein can do when they set their minds to it. Anita's been after us to do this for years because she wanted to do more for the more vulnerable in our community. And now we've done it.
Thank you. And Anita, thank you so much. Would you say something for the This Way Out radio audience?
I would just say that everybody should keep their hopes up and know that there's so much passion and support in this community that things will get done.
I can't believe it actually happened.
Ari DeSano.
I used to work here in another building that used to be an old DMV, and the center bought that building, and it was crazy. It was like a huge, empty, crazy building from the 1970s. And then that was...
No character, no personality.
Oh, it was crazy. If you... Yeah, imagine the 1970s DMV and, like, apocalyptic abandoned. Like, it was just like somebody... They left one day and never came back. And that was our building.
Taser with This Way Out Radio.
Hi, Brian.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How about you?
Good, thanks. Good. How are you feeling today?
Amazing.
City of West Hollywood Council members John Duran and John Heilman.
I used to be one of the people on the phone to the center back in the 80s, early 80s, and it was over on Highland. Just one room, hotline for STDs, and now to see all this, it's just amazing.
Right, and it's 50 years. It's been from the beginning until this.
Yeah.
Right.
Amazing, amazing day.
Right.
I mean, and to be eyewitness to it all, I feel really blessed. It's been really a blessing to me, and I wish to watch us go from there all the way to you.
Thank you so much.
Hi, how are you? Nice.
How are you feeling? What are your emotions today as you're watching the people come by?
This is really exciting. It's such a great accomplishment for the community, and it's going to serve the community for many years to come.
Can you tell me about your experience from the Stonewall era and what it means to be here today?
Very proud.
Bishop Clemens.
Very happy and absolutely awed and overwhelmed, because going back to Stonewall, one couldn't possibly envision what's happening today. I was living in New York City, quite near the Stonewall bar, and it was very interesting because my lover at the time, John, who has since died, and I were just down the street from where it was happening and didn't realize it. We were walking home and going up West 4th, and we noticed a bit of a commotion going on down by Sheridan Square. And John, oh, something's going on down there. And he walked back and came back to me at Stonewall and said, oh, there's obviously, you know, some kind of a little set-to going on, and there's a bunch of queens doing high kicks at the police. And we thought that was very strange, but we weren't going to get involved with doing high kicks at the police. And that was Stonewall in John's and my life.
So tell me what it's like being here for you today.
This is unbelievable.
David Park Epstein.
I've been in our community for 50 years, and this is a remarkable, remarkable dream come true, because we're telling the world we're not going anywhere. You may want to drive us back in the closet. You may want to drive us out of the country. But we're not going anywhere, baby. We just laid down $110 million to tell you we are a family. We take care of our own. And you can go yourself.
And can you describe just what it's going to be like for seniors and youth to work, be together?
You know, this is going to be an intergenerational event. And I think... people think, oh, well, the older people are going to help the young people. But, you know, this is a two-way street. You know, the young people have as much, perhaps more, to offer in some areas. Yes, they can learn about our community and get guidance and hopefully some strength from people who have endured incredible oppression and are still here today.
I think, what can we instill in everyone? Or by example, we certainly are doing something good.
Lily Tomlin.
But how can you make people get that where there's so little opportunity, possibly even economic opportunity, you've got to get forces that are able to do something, build something, and just start, even if it's in a little shack. Start and do something. Make it known. See how people behave, how they blossom and get better, and they're assimilated and they declare themselves. And it goes back so far for us. I don't know.
Right.
You just have to do it. You just have to start and do it.
And finally, from the stage where the ribbon was cut, the California Democratic United States Congressman Adam Schiff.
It is such a treat to join all of you and to see this magnificent facility behind me. I want to congratulate the Los Angeles LGBT Center on the grand opening of this magnificent, revolutionary Anita Mae Rosenstein campus. Envisioned by the LGBT Center more than a decade ago, this remarkable campus is the product of the hard work and dedication of community members, city staff, architects, donors, and local leaders across the county. For half a century, the Los Angeles LGBT Center has championed LGBT individuals and families in greater LA, providing services for members of the community and more so than any other organization in the world. This beautiful new campus will allow the center to continue its important work and further expand its programs and services. The campus will serve as the center's headquarters, allowing for the McDonald Wright Building to become solely a health and medical center to meet the growing demand for health-related services. This community owes a debt of gratitude to the LA LGBT Center for its unwavering endeavors to build a better, healthier, and more equal world. And I am so honored to represent this exceptional organization and to celebrate this groundbreaking achievement with you.
This was celebrating the first phase of the campus. The second phase of the campus, scheduled to open in mid-2020, will have 99 units of affordable housing for seniors and 25 supportive housing apartments for youth. For more information, you can go to lalgbtcenter.org. I'm Brian DeShazer from Hollywood, California, for This Way Out Radio.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and Laura Dickinson Turner, produced with Brian DeShazer, and from Brian DeShazer. Randy Rainbow and Joan Baez performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them during the Great Give Out Day online extravaganza benefiting LGBTQ nonprofits on April 18th. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 3ECB Croydon, Victoria, CFUV Victoria, British Columbia, WOJB Hayward, Wisconsin, and some 200 stations and other outlets around the world, including this one. Now y'all stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In February, Trump pulled out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. The U.S. has also begun construction of its first long-range nuclear weapons since the demise of the Soviet Union. Both indicate an end to over 50 years of traditional nuclear arms control. Yet the kind of mass movements against nuclear weapons that grew up in the 1970s and 80s are not to be found. However, since that time, dedicated activists with the Plowshares movement have consistently committed acts of civil resistance against nuclear weapons. Most recently, the Kings Bay Plowshares 7, who last April broke into a Trident submarine base in Georgia. They are facing up to 25 years in prison. Today, I'm joined by two of the seven. Claire Grady is a longtime human rights activist. And Martha Hennessy is a Catholic peacemaker. She's also the daughter of Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. Martha, why did you choose the Kings Bay Trident submarine base for your actions?
This naval base is home port to six of the U.S. Trident subs and three or four of the United Kingdom subs. They are also maintained there. And this is the deadliest weapon system on Earth. it has enough firepower to destroy all life on Earth, causing planetary extinction and annihilation. And we chose to go there for our symbolic action to raise awareness of the deadliness of this particular system.
And what did you do when you were at the base? How did you get in, and what action did you take?
We walked through a gate, and we brought with us an indictment, and we also left a book, The Doomsday Machine, written by Daniel Ellsberg, and we poured blood, and we put up crime tape, and we symbolically disarmed a mock missile display. We call it the missile shrine, and we symbolically hammered on those missiles and poured blood and left a banner that read, "The logic of Trident is omnicide."
Claire, why was this an act of civil resistance, not civil disobedience?
We understand that the supreme laws of our land outlaw weapons of mass destruction, and that these weapons are the ultimate weapon of mass destruction. So it's often spoken of as international law, like it's not U.S. law, but actually all treaties, pacts, and protocols that we have signed and ratified according to Article 6, Section 2 of our Constitution, become supreme laws of our land. So we have these treaties, and most people know that we don't always do so good with treaties. Native people of this land would be the first to tell you that. But we do have these treaties that were hard won after lots of bloodshed in major wars last century. And so not only are these weapons that don't discriminate between civilians and non-civilians, or combatants and non-combatants, and are not only are they weapons that contaminate the water, the land, and the air for forever, but there's laws that went into place after the Second World War during Nuremberg that basically reflect a little bit of higher consciousness that if your government is exterminating people or committing crimes against humanity, then you are responsible for interrupting that if you know about that. So that, I would say, is a pretty firm spiritual law, but that it also has been codified and signed and ratified by the United States in Nuremberg. And we know that laws are chosen, picked and choose from which ones that are going to be upheld. And but we like to think that we are standing on firm footing, one, to call a halt to this, our government's war crime, and to actually do that disarming ourselves as a matter of responsibility, so that this is actually upholding the law, and that's why we call it civil resistance.
So you just talked about international law and national law that would make these weapons illegal, and yet at the same time, obviously, we operate in a world and in a country that is highly armed. How do you hope that your actions can affect that?
Yeah, so I think we're getting right to the heart of things, Sasha. A nonviolent symbolic disarmament action. When I first heard about the Plowshares 8 action back in the early 80s, I was living in New York City. I'd been doing community organizing with the United Farm Workers, and I heard about this hammering of a nose cone in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, the Mark 12A, and I thought, well, for one thing, that's dangerous. But apparently it was just the nose cone, the metal part. And the second thought I had was, oh, my God, that's ridiculous. If they're thinking they're going to have this government disarm itself, that's like asking the government, U.S. government, to decapitate itself. It's just not going to happen. And after I identified that sequence for myself, I realized, oh, they're not asking anyone to do anything. They're doing it themselves. So that's kind of like a different orientation that says, well, especially with these laws that are unenforceable, really, you know, like who's gonna force the biggest bully to do anything, like without, I mean, using weapons, right? Or it's like it either has to happen manifested by the grassroots, or and I trust, Sasha, that there, in my 60 years, that there is always movement when anyone takes one part of this ball of wax and acts truthfully, acts justly, takes down the veil of falsehoods, that it makes space for all of us, space and energy for all of us to know a little bit more about the truth, to know a little bit more about human possibilities and sort of universal assistance. There is like a, I would say, divine sort of arc of the universe is how I see it, at least. So there's it opens up possibilities with other nonviolent symbolic actions that I consider to be civil resistance, upholding the supreme laws of our land. When they resonate as true with people, who some are community organizers, like with the St. Patrick's Four action here in Ithaca in 2003, when we poured a small amount of our blood in the entranceway of the Marine Recruiting Center. Eventually, when we had our second trial, we went through two trials, and the second one was a federal trial and was held in Binghamton. And there's an incredible community organizer there, Tariq Abdulazim, who recently ran for mayor. But he heard about our case, interviewed us, and then he made it like he tagged on and did his own thing. Like he organized a citizens' tribunal and had all these people sort of testify to what was being kept out in the courtroom. So all that is, I imagine, to be on a continuum of more truth, more critical analysis, more sense of people's power. And I can only trust that that will move us forward, those things.
And we'll talk more as we go on about the relationship between these actions and wider movements opposing nuclear weapons. But I wanted to ask you, Martha, about the situation that you are in right now, in terms of the case that seven of you broke into the Kings Bay Trident submarine base last April. And four of you, I understand, are out on bail, living with GPS ankle monitors and under curfew. And three are still in jail. Tell us about their situation and your situation.
Yes, the three who remain in jail are Elizabeth McAllister, Stephen Kelly, Jesuit priest, and Mark Koval. Mark was out briefly for cancer treatment, but is now back in. And the four of us, Patrick O'Neill, Carmen Trotta, Claire, and myself, chose to take the $5,000 bail and the $50,000 bond and the ankle monitors so that we could come out and start to speak about the situation with our nuclear arsenal and to try and do more public education. And so our lives are quite restricted. I think that the ankle monitors do function as a gag order rather effectively. We're not allowed to travel without permission from the court. I myself spend time between my home in Vermont and doing volunteer work at the Catholic Worker in New York City. But we are working very hard to get the story out about this action and the concerns we have about our current nuclear threat.
So what is your legal status at this point? Obviously, you're under these restrictions, but what is the status of your cases? What kind of charges are you facing?
We face charges of conspiracy, depredation of naval property, destruction of government property, and trespass. And we are using the Religious Freedom Restoration Act as part of our defense, and we are still waiting from the courts to make a decision about whether to accept our motion to dismiss based on religious freedom. And that has been going on to 12 weeks now. January 16th was the last activity that we had in court where supplemental briefs were submitted. And so we suspect that the courts are working very, very hard to try and address this particular and unique approach that we're using for our case on nuclear disarmament.
So is it fair to say then this religious freedom defense is something that has not been historically used in the past? I mean, as we will discuss, there have been more than 100 plowshares actions. What is the legal basis of this one contrasted against some of those?
Yes, I think that Liz McAllister and her husband, Phil Berrigan, did try to use this defense and did raise it in the 1980s. And I don't know the details about why the court refused to accept it, but we now have the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which came into play as of 1993. And as far as the legal basis for trying this particular approach, one of our attorneys just came up with the idea, and it was very much, he said, in his words, he said, your case has been hijacked by the Holy Spirit. And as far as the legal arrangements go, of course, it's not good law. It has now been used to discriminate against employees regarding birth control and health insurance coverage. But we are hoping to use it in a manner that shows that our faith compels us to take the action that we took and to be held under this sort of Damocles of the nuclear holocaust that we're so capable of producing. We are saying this goes against our faith, and we just have no idea what the outcome is going to be, obviously.
And you're facing up to 25 years in federal prison each, is that correct?
Yes, I think each of the counts of trespass is 6 months. It's a misdemeanor. But the three felonies, I think they're threatening 5 to 10 years each.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm talking with Martha Hennessy, whose voice you just heard. She is one of the seven defendants in the action against nuclear weapons at the Kings Bay Trident submarine base in Georgia last April. She is joined by Claire Grady, another of the seven who face serious charges in federal prison for their actions. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So this was the 101st plowshares action taken since 1980, and Claire, you mentioned your awareness of the first. I wanted to ask you about the history of those actions, starting with the first, which the radical priests and brothers Daniel and Philip Berrigan took part in and ultimately was depicted in the film In the King of Prussia. What was that first action?
So the first action was the Plowshares 8, it was called. And it was in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, at General Electric, where they make the nose cones for the Mark 12A warhead. And there were eight people. It was September 1980. It was eight people that went in. There were several priests. So anyway, that was the first Plowshares action. And I think that it's fair to say that that action stood in the tradition of nonviolent symbolic action from the decades before, during the Vietnam War, with Catonsville being probably one of the more outstanding or historically noted cases where they burned draft files in a garbage can and went to trial saying it's better to burn paper than lies. And so anyway, this was the first of quite a few actions. Several a year took place in the following years after that first action. And my sister Ellen and my brother John took part in the Plowshares number 4, also disarming part of the Trident submarine. This was in Electric Boat in Groton, Connecticut, where they're being made, where, by the way, 12 more are commissioned. That's quite a lot of trillions of dollars to be made at that same shipyard in Groton, Connecticut in the near future. But anyway, that action, the Plowshares number four, I think was the fourth Plowshares action, and it was in 1982. And then I actually went to their trial and realized how I felt moved with a sense of obligation and a sense of inspiration to actually do something, because I was given so much knowledge, not only about the weapons themselves, but about U.S. courts and how they were upholding these omnicidal illegal weapons, protecting them. And they were silencing the people. And it seemed like a really good thing to take part in that movement to push back that kind of silencing and to act truthfully and justly with this kind of disarming process. I think what's really important for me to say, Sasha, is that when I did that action back in the 80s, it was 1983, the doomsday clock was 3 minutes to midnight, and I was in my mid-20s, and I really felt the sense of urgency that if these weapons are launched, we would see omnicide. And now, when I took this action in 2018, my sense has grown to see that these weapons are deadly even if we don't launch them, that they are used every day in the way a cocked gun is used. And even if you don't pull the trigger and launch that bullet, that gun is being used if you're holding it to someone's head. So that's actually an image that Daniel Ellsberg offers, and I totally have felt that way for many years now, in recent years, seeing that this weapon is like the biggest bully stick on the planet, and that there's everything that its power and threat, even though it's really used as a threat, has everything to do with the entire chain of violence, state-sponsored violence, down to the police gun on the street. And there was a speaker, someone at Cornell, a few months before we took the action, I was grateful to hear this fellow speak about nuclear weapons and international relationships. And he described how South Africa, for the time that they had nuclear weapons, they increased their military aid to the neighboring efforts of putting down liberation struggles in the neighboring countries in South Africa. And their military presence just increased like four or fivefold once they possessed nuclear weapons. Like, there is a relationship. I mean, it's just kind of like an old-fashioned bully mentality when you have the biggest weapons. So that was in my mind this time. And also, really notably, the mining of uranium, the refining, the testing, and the dumping of radioactive material all happens on indigenous land. And that happens on a regular basis. And that's a cost that is mostly invisibilized, but we'd like to bring that out, to make that visible and to lift up the voices and the work of the indigenous organizers down in the Southwest. There's a nuclear issues study group, and Leona Morgan is one of the main organizers, or one of the many. And here in New York, in Seneca territory, in Western New York, is organizing by Agnes Williams and Maria Mabee, because we have a nuclear dump site there that has contaminated the Cattaraugus Creek, and that's on Native land. That's the second thing, and then the third thing is just the cost of these weapons is nothing less than a theft from all the good things that we need as human beings and community. We're basically being robbed. That's 50 cents of every dollar goes to the military. So indeed, for those reasons, that's an additional reasons that were compelling for me to to disarm this weapon, which I believe is the linchpin for all these systems that enforce white supremacy and global capitalism.
And yet, in thinking about the first Plowshares action in 1980 during the Cold War era and a sense of urgency that activists had about nuclear weapons, obviously in many ways culminating in terms of numbers anyway in 1982 when 1 million people protested in Central Park against nuclear weapons. So there was a sense of urgency, of threat that saw itself manifested in all sorts of activism throughout the 1970s into the 1980s. But in contrast, we have now, although these Plowshares actions have taken place pretty consistently from that period up till now, you don't have equivalent movements today of the kind in the 70s and 80s against nuclear weapons. And I wanted to ask you why you think there is that sense that nuclear weapons are no longer a threat or such a threat that we need to mobilize around it.
Yeah, that's such an obvious observation that many of us have watched. And I remember being there at that time of 1 million people in Central Park and thousands of us risked arrest the next day. The way I want to see that, Sasha, in a positive way is, I mean, I guess there's several ways I see it. And one of them might be in a little negative way that people just lost, stopped connecting the dots or a sense of urgency on that one. But I like to think that people were attending to things that were left out before that. And so, for instance, racial justice work was really not in focus as much in the 80s, perhaps with some people and in some parts. But I'm so grateful for that, the emergence of that movement and climate justice. And I mean, all these things are connected. And as far as kind of moving past that, I don't feel everyone has to do everything, but I like at least when our analysis connects the dots and sees where we're giving away our power and where we have choices in reclaiming our power and creating a new society in the shell of the old, or wherever we are. And so I have this little corollary that's come up for me. It kind of comes up with your question. I believe that when people of privilege, so myself, a white woman of privilege in this United States, take responsibility for the big crimes of killing millions and stealing trillions. And that's done certainly with nuclear weapons, but in many ways that is done. When we take responsibility for those crimes in all the different ways that we can, we will stop scapegoating the people on the receiving end of those crimes. So I had that huge insight when I was in a prison cell one time waiting to go see a judge. And I realized, you know, whenever I'm in prison or jail, I don't call that crime that people are in there because they're living the legacy of big crimes. And they are certainly experiencing addiction and violence and brokenness, and all of that needs healing. But I just don't practice using the word crime unless it's for these big systemic institutionalized crimes. But anyway, there's this corollary for me, and I'm hoping that we see the connections enough to, withdraw our consent and stop fueling the money and stop fueling our blessing and our taxes and our everything to this machine, which is one of the biggest contributors to climate change, absolutely puts people of color on the first line of deadly force and drives global capitalism with a vengeance. And so, yeah, it's just a small effort. But sometimes little things make space for bigger things. And I hope it's a complementary effort to all the good organizing going on.
That's the voice of Kings Bay Plowshare 7 member Claire Grady. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by two of the seven defendants in the Kings Bay Plowshares case. They took an act of civil resistance at the submarine base in Georgia last April on the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination against nuclear weapons. They each face up to 25 years in federal prison. And we are talking today about the threat of nuclear weapons and activism against nuclear weapons. And I wanted to ask you, Martha, about the situation, the change situation over the period that these Plowshares actions have taken place from 1980 to the present. While there is a sense within the public more broadly that the threat of nuclear weapons went down after the Cold War, there are things that have happened recently that have made the threats that never went away even more dire. And one of those is the decision by Trump to withdraw from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. And, of course, all of the saber-rattling around Iran. And I wanted to know from you, Martha, how you see the situation now. Some of these developments, of course, having taken place even since you all took action in April of 2018.
Thank you, Sasha. You know, I think the breakup of the USSR was a golden opportunity, and the United States just immediately abused that opportunity to become the sole superpower. And, you know, my children were born in the late 70s and early 80s, and the nuclear threat is far from their minds. And I think that the longer we practice war, the more we perfect it. And so our lessons learned from the Vietnam War and our lessons learned from the end of the Cold War only were used to further our agenda of, you know, white supremacy, hegemony, and exploitation of the global resources. And as far as what Trump has recently done, this withdrawal from the INF treaty with, you know, threats to the New START treaties upcoming in 2021 and the ending of the Iran nuclear deal, all are clear indications to me what the intent is of the U.S. in terms of its willingness to dominate the globe. I have had trips to Russia. I have had trips to Iran and several other countries in the Middle East, and it's very clear to me what the intentions are. You know, I have great hope. I have great hope that the citizens will demand the reforms that are needed and that we do take advantage of our democratic system that we do have in place. I will never forget sitting in the apartment in Cairo with an Egyptian activist, and he just simply looked at me and said, "You have the means, you have the democratic means of protesting what was going on, and you need to utilize that." You know, Egypt is a completely suppressed police state, you know, given the financial aid from the United States to maintain that regime. And this is what we're faced with, a multiple pronged approach to oppressing our poor people here at home as the counterpart to the war making that we commit abroad. And there also is the problem of our media. I mean, one of the most important aspects of a democracy is a free press. And under the current circumstances with the current administration, we are in deep, deep trouble. And this has been in the making for at least 40 years, from what I can recall. I have been aware of social justice and war-making my entire life. I was made aware of it by my mother and grandmother, even as a young child. And what we're seeing now is an obvious conclusion to what we have been practicing since dropping the bomb on Japan.
Well, Martha Hennessy, what about the issue of near accidents? Clearly, when they happen, we don't hear about them. Often we don't find out about them for years or decades after the fact. But when many people have a sense that after the Cold War, they don't have to think about nuclear weapons anymore, what do we know about the threat of near accidents?
What's called the Nuclear Posture Review that came out in February of 2018, and every new incoming administration is obligated to review this. And the current administration has made some changes about computerizing more aspects of the nuclear program. And, of course, we have had many near misses throughout the history of our nuclear age. They're called broken arrow incidences, and we don't have a lot of information about what has happened. And this is where my faith comes in. I mean, we have not yet blown ourselves up, and it's a complete miracle. We have the capacity to make these mistakes, and we are coming closer and closer to making even greater mistakes. But more than that, Donald Trump wants to use the nuclear arsenal. He wants to make these weapons usable as part of his strategy of domination. And so we drift closer and closer to the dangers that Nuclear Posture Review talks about, a nuclear response to a non-nuclear threat. Now, this is crossing a very different threshold. This is not maintaining the status quo with this document of our nuclear strategy. This is opening the door for much greater danger. And we also have the information about the B-6112 missiles that are used for dial-up, dial-down kilotons. They can control the size of the explosive, which they're talking about putting on these nuclear subs. And the subs are stealth machines. You don't know where they are in the oceans on the globe. And this kind of so-called upgrade is increasing the dangers exponentially.
Martha, are you concerned about Trump's withdrawal from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and other such actions as spurring a renewed arms race, in that if the U.S. is pulling out of these things, why should any other country control its nuclear proliferation?
Yes, pulling out of the INF treaty is clearly leading to a new nuclear arms race. And we are going in the opposite direction. Of the Non-Proliferation Treaty is something that has been in place since the 1970s, I believe. And we are moving no closer to preventing the proliferation. In fact, we're going in the opposite direction. And once again, the hand of capitalism is playing a part in this. The nuclear arms race and just the conventional arms race is probably the largest profiteering operation that we have at this time. And, you know, Mr. Trump is a businessman, and his job is to free things up for the capitalists and the businessmen to make their profits with no regard to where it's leading us and what the consequences are. And we also have the New START Treaty to consider. And I believe that John Bolton has the plan of just very methodically withdrawing from any of these restraints that we have on nuclear proliferation. And I don't believe that they have the capacity to understand the insanity of what it is that they're doing.
Martha Hennessy is my guest. She is one of the Kings Bay Plowshares 7 activists who are facing serious jail time in federal prison, decades, in fact, for the action they took of civil resistance against nuclear weapons last April. What companies are key to the nuclear industry? Because, Martha, you were just talking about the dimension of profit in all of this. What companies are involved, and what are the efforts to target those companies?
Very good question. I know Lockheed Martin is very much on the top of the list. Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, I don't understand, you know, why we're not looking more closely at the economics of this, because, you know, these very few corporations are netting billions of dollars of taxpayers' money and resources of the country. You know, it's public dollars going into private pockets, and I think that once you practice this mode and you gain a certain level of controls, it's very hard to counter. And you have a combination of the people being kept in willful ignorance, and you have the corporations making the decisions, and you have the government. I mean, the definition of fascism is when corporate is running government. And I believe that we are in the advanced stages of that, where it's the capitalists who are making the decisions. I mean, we have neglected our democracy, and as far as changing that, Phil Berrigan and Martin Luther King Jr. both called for general economic strikes, and I do believe the people have the power to shut down the economy, to refuse to work and to shop, and to have a list of changes that must be made. And that seems to be the only way that we can bring this into check. And again, personal sacrifice will be part of this picture. We can call for a general strike, but then we have to face the consequences of the suffering that will come from that.
Well, this may be, this undoubtedly is a more moderate type of effort, but tell us about the campaign for divestment from nuclear weapons.
Yeah, so I think it's Cold Pink that's been that took that initiative, divest from war, and they have tons of resources. If you look on their website of what those weapons makers are, and they sort of have a template of how to go about that organizing, and they have organizers that will help you in whatever area you live in. So here in Ithaca, we have some organizing going on around that. We also have the ICANN grassroots effort that asks city councils to call for a nuclear-free zone. And through that connecting of dots verbally.
And then in terms of the struggle against the existence of nuclear weapons, what kind of actions, Martha Hennessy, would you like to see people take, or would you encourage people to take?
I think that citizens of the United States should really put pressure, you know, on their representatives and congresspersons to support the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons that was developed by ICANN and the United Nations back in July of 2017 to get that treaty ratified. And, of course, the 9 nuclear states are refusing to support it whatsoever, but I think citizens' demands for support of that treaty would be very helpful.
The ICANN, the movement for the prohibition, I think, was initiated by Costa Rica, and I forget the woman's name, but she's a Costa Rican woman who, it's just really striking how grassroots this is. And
yes,
of course, Japanese people are leading the way with that. And just that, you know, it's like people of color in a grassroots way are running with this ball. And it's a beautiful opportunity. If James Baldwin were here, he might jump in and put his name on it again. But it's one of those quiet grasshoppers, maybe. And because it doesn't have teeth, it may seem ineffectual, but I can't emphasize enough the value of this kind of grassroots thing, and they are making a lot of connections. They are connecting dots with their efforts.
Martha Hennessy, we've been talking about the anti-nuclear movement through Plowshares actions, both this recent action that took place last year, but going back really to 1980, and as Claire said, that movement to take nonviolent civil resistance, actions of nonviolent civil resistance against nuclear weapons, against the military over almost 39 years now, with, you know, serious consequences for those involved. And remarkably, a lot of people who have been involved in those actions and went to jail for it then have been involved in other actions. So it's a movement that has sustained itself over decades when there has not been a larger mass movement during all of that time focusing on nuclear weapons. And so something like that, an effort like that, doesn't just come out of nowhere. It's sustained by a community and by a philosophy or faith. And I wanted to ask you about the longer roots of the sort of communities that the Plowshares actions have come out of. And I wanted to particularly ask you about your grandmother, Dorothy Day, who was the co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. Who was Dorothy Day? What was the Catholic Worker Movement?
Dorothy Day was born in 1897. She died in 1980 when I was 25. And she was a Catholic convert. And she met Peter Maurin, the other co-founder of the movement. And the movement was born in 1933 in the depths of the Great Depression and, you know, significant mass unemployment and mass displacement internally in the country. You know, the failures of capitalism became very, very apparent. And for Dorothy and Peter, it was a question of following Catholic social teaching and ministering to the needs that are immediately in front of you. And she was in New York City, the empire city of the empire state of the U.S. empire, and her response was to follow in the tradition of Matthew 25, of feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, visiting the imprisoned. And the movement continues today. It's 85 years old. There are over 200 houses of hospitality, you know, around the country and around the world, trying to minister to the desperate needs of the homeless and picking up the pieces of the human wreckage of our capitalist system. And Dorothy clearly understood what was brewing in Europe with Hitler and World War II. And she witnessed many wars in her lifetime. And in September of 1945, she wrote a scathing piece regarding the dropping of the bomb on our Japanese brothers and sisters and breathing in the dust of those we have incinerated. And her understanding of the mystical body of Christ, being that we are all one of another, and what damage we do to one people, it's going to damage all of us. And she had a very clear understanding of that. She also began the protests, the non-consent with the nuclear air raid drills. They were arrested consistently from 1955 to 1961, sitting out on the park benches, refusing to take so-called shelter in the event of a nuclear attack on Manhattan. She understood that to be a psychological war and that people would be going to their graves to go down into the subway system for any kind of protection. And so for myself, having grown up in that milieu of knowing that war-making is always targeting the most vulnerable, the poor, women, children. And Dorothy and Peter had a vision of, you know, creating a better world in which it's easier to be good. And so these roots are rather deep. And Peter Maurin himself goes back centuries in terms of his family's commitment to the land and to agriculture. I think that there are so many moving parts of the dilemma that we have today of climate disruption and nuclear holocaust. But I, for Peter Maurin, the way that we produce our food is actually quite critical in the whole system. And the capitalist system has certainly exploited that approach in terms of gaining control of the food supply. And We also have the Atlantic Life community that Phil Berrigan began years ago, and this work cannot be done outside of community as far as I'm concerned. I could not participate in what I have been participating in if not for all of that upbringing and training and understanding what is going on in the world and how we address poverty, war, and oppression. And we rely on the beloved community to be able to continue with these kinds of actions.
Let me end by asking you about the kind of support that, if people are listening to this program and they would like to support the Kings Bay Plowshare 7, what kind of support would you all find most useful at this point, starting with you, Martha?
I think the more we can educate ourselves, and we have a website, kingsbayplowshare7.org. You can go there for further information. But I think educating ourselves on the nuclear arsenal, on the foreign policy as we have implemented it in all of these decades of war making, and also looking at how we have not held the Bush administration accountable for the war crimes. I mean, this is not something that happens overnight, and it's very important for us to study our own history and to study it, you know, with a frankness about why we have come to the place that we're at now with our democracy slipping from our hands.
And Claire, what kind of support would you like to see or inspired action from the action that you and six others took last April at the Kings Bay Trident submarine base?
Yes. Keep doing whatever you're doing. If you're doing good work in organizing and teaching, keep doing that. But if you're at all interested, coming to the trial is one way to support us. But also to keep the movement growing. And I know when I was younger and our parents were doing draft board actions that there were hundreds of those draft board actions. And being at trials was one of the places, or sort of like a seminary or whatever, or people, because it happens, as Martha stated, in community. And that's where community is cultivated. And the courtroom, I understand it to be a place where the war of the myths goes on. A lot of unmasking that happens during trials, and that's energizing. And you know, when Martha said study and so on, that's a classroom right there, and it's community building, and there's opportunities for more actions, sort of an integrated experience. So if you're drawn to that, coming to Brunswick, Georgia, whenever we do have trial is one way to support.
And will there be information on the Kings Bay Plowshares website about the details of the trial as it becomes known?
Do you
have any sense of when that will be, when the trial will be, or is that just not clear at this point?
It seems as though the courts are working very hard to figure out how to get to the a conclusion that they need, you know, to silence our voices. And we're not sure how long this, I mean, it looks like non-cooperation on the part of the courts, but I think that they have the right to not make a decision for some time to come, but we are hoping that some movement will come in the next month or two.
Martha Hennessy, Claire Grady, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sasha.
I've been speaking with two of the seven defendants in the Kings Bay Plowshares action that took place at the Kings Bay Trident submarine base in Georgia last April on the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. They face up to 25 years in federal prison. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time.
Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.